We are live Tuesday night this week because, there's just a lot to cover. I thought we'd do the show early this week. Australia Day coming up this weekend. It's going to be a big one. Donald Trump is president. Been a very eventful day. Elon Musk throwing Romans at the inauguration. It's just a lot to unpack. There's a lot to discuss. So why not jump on the stream and have a powwow? I think the audience is keen for some breakdowns and analysis. So nice to be with you on a Tuesday night. And it is the 21st of January, 2025. Tuesday night here in Australia. Obviously, we've probably got some friends from overseas watching. But look, let's talk about the fun stuff first. Elon Musk throwing a Roman. There's serious stuff to discuss beyond this. But I thought it was incredibly interesting to see the reaction. Now, obviously, it was kind of this funny, autistic Roman that he threw or whatever. But for the ADL to come out and like try and explain it away, he didn't mean it in a Nazi way. He meant it in some other way. And there's all these news articles being written where they're saying, oh, no, it wasn't a Nazi salute. It's like an ancient part of, you know, it was from Roman times in our culture. It just means people looking forward to the future with positivity. That's all it means. And, you know, that lefties absolutely having a meltdown, people saying, oh, no, it was an accident. Meanwhile, everyone just memeing like the absolute hell out of it this morning. Some hilarious stuff online. Obviously, Tom, you were posting the picture of you throwing the Roman coming out of court from 2023. I think that picture is from, right? Maybe it was the year before. I can't remember. But anyway,
that picture of me is not, I'm not throwing a Roman. What I'm doing is I'm merely looking forward to the future in hope and strength. It's actually just the ancient symbol of my hope and strength for the future, which is kind of true. An ancient Aryan symbol that also the Nazis did.
It's almost like, do we want to call it a Roman? Because it's more ancient than the Romans.
But it's just an Aryan salute, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so it's a total optics cuck death because everyone just loved it, basically. The whole crowd cheered. It was a hilarious moment. And I guess when you're like the world's richest man, you can just throw Romans and get away with it. But it seems like a bit of like a, you know, interesting reaction. There was that Rolling Stone article that was written, neo-Nazis celebrate Elon Musk throwing a Roman, and it mentioned you, Tom. It mentioned Keith Woods. I think it mentioned Hammer from Blood Tribe talking about it. So it was quite interesting to see that reaction. But I guess what's more potent, and this is something we've talked about on the show before, is that that salute has a spiritual meaning that, you know, as I said, I think I said something to the words the akin of, you know, that's a symbol that that's why people are feeling enthusiastic about something. That's what we do. It's natural. It's part of our blood memory. And we should never ever let the enemy take it away from us. And now in Australia, it's illegal. And I know in many European countries, it's illegal. In America, it's not illegal, but it's still, you know, socially passé, to say the very least, if not just outright, like beyond the pale in a lot of social circles. And that needs to be broken. White people need to claim it back. In America, they used to call it the Bellamy Salute. 100 years ago, every kid would do the Pledge of Allegiance and throw a Roman, basically, at the beginning of school to the American flag. There's statues in Australia of Captain Cook throwing Romans. It was a universal part of white European culture. It wasn't just a Nazi thing. Now, of course, it is also a Nazi thing, and that only makes it cooler. I think it's important. It's an important battleground. It isn't, you know, there's a stigma around it, that, you know, this has gone some ways to breaking down. What are your thoughts, Blair?
Yo, yeah. Imagine. I've been laughing about it all day. Imagine being one of the richest, most powerful men in the world. And you go to the US president's inauguration, you get up on stage on the microphone, you go, and you give a Roman salute. And you don't just do it once, you turn around and do it again to make sure there's no mistake that that's what you were doing. And hey, as you said, the guy's just like rich and powerful enough to do it. Like, what can anyone do about it? He like, within that 2 seconds, made the whole day about him, about himself, I think. But I don't know. I think it's really amusing I'm seeing a lot of, oh my God, we're back on Twitter. I don't think we're back on X, I should say. I'm old school. I still call it Twitter. Then I'm seeing a lot of, oh, this is a psyop. It's all part of some intricate psyop to get us on board. Then they're going to screw us over. I think it's just Elon being a spurg. I think it's just Elon enjoying himself in the moment and not really caring. I think it's just one of those autisms. Musk had an autism. It was pretty funny. And it shows at least that politics of the future, American politics at least, will be a little bit less controlled, slightly less controlled perhaps, and more entertaining. So I'm excited for the future.
I don't think it was Elon being a spurg. I think it was very intentional personally. I think it was very intentional.
It looked off the cuff for me. It looked like he didn't think a lot about it. I could be wrong. It looked like
he did it once. He turned around. He did it again, facing the opposite direction. Then he uploaded the video of it immediately to Twitter, and then was laughing about all the memes about it all day. I think Elon Musk very intentionally wanted the whole world to see him do that. He wanted to be celebrated. Elon Musk is a megalomaniac. He wants us to like him, as has been very clear. His whole meltdown during the H-1B argument. The H1 Bolocaust, then him going so hard on the Paki rape gangs to try and win us back over. Now, of course, he's also trying to involve himself in British politics, and that's part of it as well. But he cares about our support as like the general kind of pro-white, dissident right, radical right, populist right scene. He wants us to think he's cool. He wants us to like him. He wants us to meme him. And that's part of his cultural cachet, because the left don't like him. He needs us to like him for him to be a popular figure. And additionally, it was also, you know, a way for it to be made all about him again. You know, today's supposed to be Trump's big day, but everyone's talking about Elon Musk. You know, he's got all the attention on him again. Everyone's talking about him. No one stopped talking about him for years now, like the last 2 years, every news headline is
that, though. It's almost like he would show Trump the respect to give Trump the day. It's Trump's inauguration. You'd think he'd just stay quiet, keep his head down for once, but nope.
He's not there. I can do whatever the fuck I want. I'm Elon Musk, and just does it, you know?
I got to say, I like him for this. Like, I don't know what Elon's about politically. I've got no idea what he's up to. But his personality is definitely entertaining. I'm having a good time following Elon Musk and what he's doing publicly. I admire the guy for just seemingly, you know, not caring, just doing whatever he wants in the moment and not really caring about the reaction and enjoying all the controversy that he's stirring up. He's a fun kind of a guy. I'm glad he's on board. And by on board, I don't really mean on board with our politics specifically. I'm just glad he's in politics. I'm glad the guy's on the scene. It's making everything really interesting. What do you reckon, Sewell?
Yeah, I had a lot of people on my Twitter say to me, oh, do you think this is some sort of psyop, or, you know, like what's the machinations of this? And I ignored all the comments because I couldn't be bothered, because I was just having too much fun. And my response, the first time I did reply, was, I don't know, man, I'm just enjoying the chaos. Like, the richest man in the world just threw a Roman salute at President Trump's second inauguration. What the fuck is going on? This is just, and this might sound a little narcissistic, but I said to Beck today, I said, do you reckon he would have done it if Wignats hadn't been memeing the Roman salute into existence for like the last 3-4 years?
Fair question.
Like, if we weren't just on the news constantly, Roman salutes, people getting banned for Roman salutes, people going to jail for Roman salutes, like, Musk banned me off Twitter for 6 months because I uploaded a profile picture of me doing a Roman salute. And then he comes out, he lets me back on Twitter. Then he comes out and throws a Roman salute. There could be something esoteric in the Wignat, you know, billionaire alliance. Like, it's not a physical alliance. It doesn't exist in the material plane, but maybe in the astral plane with like some sort of Aryan priest caste, we have like injected our philosophy. And I actually, yeah, I was going to raise one thing. I saw, not that these things were premonitions, but it was just interesting timing that Elijah Schaefer put up a video last night on his Twitter about, you know, it was like a whole video of all these different Roman salutes throughout movies and history. and just saying, like, why is this banned in Australia? This shouldn't be banned in Australia. This is like a perfectly normal thing to do. And I'm pretty sure that was like 4 or 5 hours before Musk threw the salute. And at the same time that Schaefer put that up, I put up an article. I'd never written an article for Twitter before, but it's actually got this really cool formatting system. And I just wrote an article called Liberal Sacrifice. And
Hang on. You can write your own news articles through Twitter.
It's not a news article, but when you're writing a post, if it's like an effort post, if you're putting a bit of effort into it, it posts it differently to your profile. You can, if you've got premium Twitter, you can write it as an article now. You can put like a header, you can put like a picture attached to your article, and then you write out your post, and it doesn't upload as a normal post that expands in a normal sense. It's as if it's like you're writing a news article.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
It opens up within Twitter. Just check it out. It's called Liberal Sacrifice. It's my first go at writing a short article for Twitter. And the contention of the article, and I used the graphic that I used was of like Odin throwing a Roman salute. And the contention of the article is just simply that we have to sacrifice a piece of liberalism with inside of us in order to create the society we want. And I thought it was kind of funny waking up in the morning seeing Musk, who's a liberal, like he's a classical liberal, kind of libertarian type character. It's doing that salute does kill a little part of your own kind of liberalism. Like he can't recover from that ever, in a sense that he's opened a door now that he can't close. He can't go back. Like there was a few things that were contentious. Like about 2 or 3 weeks ago, he replied to someone who had said that if you're against these grooming gangs, you're a fascist or something like that. And then he kind of replied to that saying, well, I guess I'm a fascist. Or I'm sure Joel knows the exact message that he sent, but it was very similar to that. He basically borderline says, well, if fascism are the guys that are against child rape, then I'm one of those. And you can kind of, that's excusable in the sense that you're not condoning fascism. You're not like, that's kind of like a mental foreplay argument. Whereas being on stage and actually doing the action and seeing the media response is just fascinating. Seeing the media in this strange kind of way, they don't want to give power to the Roman, so that to the fascist salute, to the Nazi salute. So they're saying, no, he didn't actually. They're trying to like explain how it wasn't actually a Nazi salute. It was just like a gesture of his excitement. And it's it. Last thing I'll say is, the emperor is not wearing any clothes, you know? Like, oh, I really enjoy the emperor's new clothes. Like we're all going to sit there and pretend that wasn't a Nazi salute? Crazy. It's awesome. Yeah. I'm ecstatic. It's Donald Trump power moment.
Elon Musk always talks about his affinity for the Roman Empire and for Rome. He's discussed this many, many times. And so his explanation, I would anticipate, if he ever does explain what happened there, would probably be that he saw it as in that vein, and that he's like he's reclaiming the salute, and he would probably give that expanded discussion about how it isn't something that was just conjured up by the Nazis. It's an ancient gesture that has many other connotations, and so he doesn't want to just give it to the Nazis. He's doing it in that sense. He's not necessarily assenting to Hitler or the tenets of National Socialism by doing it. I would anticipate he would give an explanation like that, but that's fine because I mean that's actually legitimate. It's a legitimate thing to say, you know. So be interesting if that debate ends up now playing out in the aftermath of this, or if he just pretends like nothing happened and just continues on or something like how. But
it's a mockery of Australian law. The recent change to Australian law when they're like, oh, this is an illegal gesture in Australia now, and then the most powerful man in the world gets on stage and does it.
Yeah, exactly.
Did Donald Trump say anything about the salute? Has Donald Trump reacted? Has anyone of notes reacted, or is it just like leftist media?
Well, people have reacted, like a lot of left-wing politicians in America, like were freaking out about it and stuff. But no, Trump himself didn't say anything, but he had a pretty busy day.
I would have liked to have seen Barron's face. If some camera panned onto Barron's face while Elon was doing the salute, I would have liked to have seen how he took it. If Barron gave even the slightest smirk, he's on board.
But he did the Hitler response. That was epic. I think
Barron did.
Yeah, Baron did the you know how Hitler would do that when everyone would throw the Roman, he'd do the Hitler response. Baron did that gesture.
Really?
So, yeah.
This is hilarious, man. I can't. It's also sudden as well. It's like it feels like last month the whole world was against us, and what's even happening right now? I don't know.
Well, I can explain it. Like, I could bring it back down to earth a little bit with an explanation. But you know, the thing is, like, yeah, okay.
Are you going to rain on our parade? Is that what you're going to do? You're going
to
rain on the parade?
I have to. I got to piss on your bonfire because, I mean, just today it came out. So, like, yeah, there's been, I guess, some good news because there's like the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, that Elon Musk is installed as the leader of now by the Trump administration. He was going to co-lead it with Vivek Ramaswamy, that Indian, but he got tossed, apparently. So people are kind of celebrating that. But the thing is, apparently Elon Musk is now arguing with the immigration, basically everyone that's in charge of immigration within the Trump administration over the H-1Bs and the Indians. And Musk is still championing bringing Indians in for tech. And this is apparently a very, like, people were tweeting about it today. This is an active debate within the administration. We'll see who wins, who loses. So, you know, Elon Musk, he's throwing Romans, but he's still trying to import Pajits into America. So it's like, okay, well, that's not very Hitlerian. And like, look, what I see, the reason why Musk is putting his money and his influence behind, you know, basically going after the wokes, and, you know, getting Trump back in, and now he's going into Europe and he's trying to get, you know, the populist right installed in European countries. And he's saying things that are playing to some of our talking points on many issues. It's not because he's a white nationalist or because he's our guy. It's because he has recognized a couple simple truths. The first truth is that the American economy is basically fucked, and all Western economies are basically fucked. They're massively over-leveraged. In order for them to continue functioning, because the thing is, you know, basically for the economy to work, all these investment bankers need to make exorbitant profits. If they don't continue making exorbitant profits, they can't pay back the insane debts that they have. And you know, the leverage of the system falls apart, because the thing is that all the debt in the system is converted it's basically converted into assets that then get traded around by, you know, all the top investors. So the economy has to keep growing. Everyone has to keep making profits. Otherwise, the whole thing comes crumbling down. There's never been this much interconnected leverage in any financial system ever in world history. So in order for that to happen, asset prices have to keep going up, and the value of labor also has to keep going up, which means basically they have to get more out of the American worker or the Australian worker or whatever, while simultaneously making everything more expensive, right? House prices have to go up. Every single basically major asset class has to go up in value. Otherwise, this whole thing comes crumbling down. So obviously, in order to facilitate that, immigration, you know, is, you know, as we can see in Australia, that's why they're bringing in Indian immigrants to kind of keep this whole, you know, shit show continuing. And we can see how that's really parasitical upon our quality of life and how it's really destroying Australia, much worse in Australia than in America. The only way to be able to get all of that to kind of work without screwing over the workers and pushing us, you know, into a position where we get into like a revolutionary posture is to basically build AI. Because the logic is, if they can build AI technology, a lot of these investors can put their money in all of these tech startups that will become multi-trillion dollar or multi-billion dollar companies more realistically, and make shitloads of profit that'll facilitate economic growth. But also it'll make labor more productive, because say you're working for a company and that company now only has to have half the size of the workforce that it used to have to produce the same stuff, because it can automate a whole bunch of jobs with AI. You know, that basically means they can afford to pay the workers that they have left more. And so this was actually admitted by that Jew, Larry Fink, who runs BlackRock, which is the world's largest investment bank. He's been going on and on for years about how we need to have more immigrants, because otherwise we're going to have to pay workers too much and we won't be able to afford to do it. Now he's changed his tune and said, you know, well, actually, a lot of these countries that have restrictive like in East Asia that restrict immigration, they'll probably do well with AI automation, because the thing is, even though their population is shrinking, we're going to automate away half the jobs anyway, so we don't need as many people anymore. And it's going to actually cause problems in the West if we have these, like, you know, multiracial societies, and all of a sudden we automate away, you know, half the jobs. So there seems to be a recognition in the kind of elite, you know, investor class in America that in order for basically to get the economy to progress, to get technology to progress, in order to continue the charade so that they don't blow up the economy, and also, you know, massage politics in the correct direction, they have to wind back the wokeness, get rid of DEI, let, you know, young white people rise through the ranks and build the technology that'll take things to the next level. Because the thing is, if you have DEI and you put a bunch of like Indians and like, you know, Shaniqua, you know, black chicks and so on in charge of everything, and like trannies and all this kind of nonsense, well, you're not going to build AI faster than the Chinese. You know, the whole thing is going to fall apart. So they're trying to like elevate the position of the white man, because they need the white man to build AI, to build spaceships, to build all the stuff that they need to advance to the next level technologically, economically, as well as...
And to maintain it too. That sort of stuff needs a lot of maintenance, right? So you need to keep white people around for the maintenance.
Yeah. Also, they're trying to compete with China, and there's an imminent war with China. So they need to re-inspire patriotism. They, you know, we can't have, you know, we've talked about this on the show a lot as well, but also, so they're trying to compete technologically, economically, militarily with a serious adversary, as well as keep the economy together. And so there's this like balancing act where until they can build AI, they need to like stuff the country full of Indians to keep all the leverage in place that they need, because otherwise basically the cost of labor will start going up because they're not replacing us with foreign workers. They'll have to pay everyone more. And then that will then make it impossible for companies to do business, and you know, the whole thing could fall apart for that reason. So like basically the parasite class at the top have made a giant mess, and they've over-leveraged themselves in this giant mess, as well as a lot of them are Jewish, and like Israel's under threat and so on. And if we have like, if the American empire blows up, how can it protect Israel? Also, they've got all these massive companies built out of America. How can Elon Musk get his, you know, space rockets to Mars if the American empire blows up and the economy blows up and they lose World War III to China? It's not going to be possible. So whether that be technological kind of aspirations, whether they be, you know, Zionist aspirations, we're just holding on to their fucking money. If they keep grinding the white man into the dirt with absolutely zero concessions and zero reasonableness, it's all going to, you know, basically the parasite is going to consume the host and the whole thing's going to come crashing down. And that, I think, is basically what's driving the behavior of people like Elon Musk and why Trump has been allowed to win and come back in. And, you know, they're basically making concessions to us in various ways that we've been noticing. That's why this is happening. It's not because we're winning the argument or something. It's just because like reality, I think, is like dawning on a lot of these elites.
Do you think China is the greatest military threat to America right now? And if China and America were to go to war right now, who would win?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say. We've talked about this on the show before in the past, because
China's got the experience or like the manpower, but they don't really have the experience.
Well, it's not necessarily about it, because if there was a war between the United States and China, it's taking place in East Asia. And America's not going to invade China. If you try to invade China, they'll wipe you out. They've got an insane, they've got 1.4 billion people. They've got millions and millions of soldiers. How are you going to like, you know, put your troops there and like get an invasion force and occupy a country of that scope? It's impossible.
Is there a way to cut the whole thing surrounding?
They wouldn't do that. The way that they would fight them.
Yeah, sorry.
That's what I'm thinking. How do you cut off? You'd want to cut China off resources, wouldn't you? So is that practical?
You bomb them.
Yeah, so the war would be a naval battle.
Blood all of them.
The war would be largely a naval battle and an air battle, because the thing is that China is dependent upon a lot of trade that goes by sea, right? Because China doesn't have enough natural resources to run its economy. It also is a net food importer. It grows a lot of food, but they've got 1.4 billion people. That's a lot of mouths to feed, right? So they need to be able to import a lot in of like raw materials, food, like agricultural products, oil. oil's got to come in. But then at the same time, their entire economy is built around exporting to the world. So they also need to sell their crap to the rest of the world for, you know, to keep their people employed. So if America comes in with the Navy and shuts down the shipping lanes in East Asia and cuts China off from being able to engage in this international trade, then they've got to try and do it by land. Trying to do it by land is going to be a giant bitch because it's actually like hundreds of times more expensive to move cargo by land than by sea. First of all, second of all, they're going to have to travel across Eurasia, over the top of India, into the Middle East, into Europe. Plus, America is also allied with a lot of these European countries. And also, America is the number one purchaser of Chinese crap in the world. So China's going to be in a very difficult position. So the objective of the Americans, they don't necessarily need to go into China and invade it and occupy it. If they can kind of block China off from accessing the rest of the world, militarily, diplomatically, China will eventually have a famine. The people will start starving. They won't. The economy will start grinding to a halt, and it will like fall apart internally. That would be the strategy. So the question is, does China have the capacity to like smash their way through that? I'm skeptical that they do. They could definitely do a lot of damage, though. But I think I think the Americans are more likely to win a World War III scenario like that than China, because China's just in a really difficult position. Because they're basically having to go on the offense. They'd have to go out and secure not just like their immediate area, they'd have to go and basically take over all of Southeast Asia, bomb the shit out of Australia, bomb the shit out of India, destroy the entire US Navy, which is the world's biggest Navy, blow up all of their aircraft carriers, just destroy everything. And then to make it totally safe for commercial shipping to flow through East Asia or through Southeast Asia into East Asia. Because the thing is, like, you're a commercial shipper and you're running ships from the Middle East or from Europe into East Asia. And there's an active war between China and America, and America's blowing shit up and impounding ships. Imagine the insurance cost to put a crew and a ship and send, like, you know, barrels of oil or whatever to China. You're not going to do business under those conditions. It's impossible. So China would have to totally defeat America, whereas all America and its allies, which includes us and the Japanese, the Indians, the British, whatever, all we have to do is just sit there and blow up a few ships or just create enough of a mess that the ships stop, and then China's fucked. So that gives like a massive advantage to our side. That's the reason why China hasn't invaded Taiwan yet, because obviously Taiwan's very small, China's massive. You think they could just like set upon Taiwan and fuck it up. But the reason why they're cautious to do so is if they triggered that outcome, America could then collapse the entire Chinese economy and then set them back like, you know, 50 years.
Does that mean war is not going to happen anytime soon? It's almost like there's a trade war happening, and there has been a trade war happening for a while. But I'm not really schooled in all the ins and outs of that, so I won't comment. But would China be able to muster up any allies if an open war situation did develop?
Yeah, obviously, I think the Russians are with them. The Iranians are with them. A lot of the Eurasian countries with China, because they have a lot of trade with China, like the Pakistanis, a lot of the Muslim countries are leaning towards China over America. America's alienated them for a lot of reasons, obviously. And also China has a lot of allies in, you know, South America and Africa and stuff. But does that really matter too much under these conditions? Probably not. And that's also part of the reason why Trump is going to try and probably clean things up in Ukraine and normalize relations with Russia, because that makes this whole situation worse. If he can kind of win Russia back into a bit more of a neutral position, that only weakens China's relative position. So these are like the larger dynamics that are going on and contextualizing what's happening in politics, you know. And I think you have to take all that into account to explain how come like 2 years ago Trump was getting put in prison. And if you didn't agree that there was 48 genders, like maybe you were going to get put in prison. And now, you know, Trump's barging in and the beaners are going to get deported. And, you know, Elon Musk is talking about Paki rape gangs and we're all back on Twitter and he's throwing Romans. You know, what the fuck's going on? I think that's what's going on. Like, if you look at these larger dynamics, it explains why a portion of the American elite and the Jews are like, fuck, like we kind of need to bring a little bit of like, we need to turn the tap of white power, not to 100, because they're afraid of if it goes to 100, it would also overwhelm them. But like we need like, you know, 30% white power or something, or 40%. They're trying to find that perfect ratio of white power to restabilize the system and you know, maintain like the strength of the status quo and defend it against its enemies and its internal instabilities. Because if they just have like runaway leftism, you know, this whole thing is not sustainable. It's just going to eat itself.
Wonder what that means for the average punter, the average working class American, Australian. Would things improve much, their standard of living, the demographics? Probably not. As you said, what we've summarized is that the immigration is probably going to continue because the whole American Western economy is like a Ponzi scheme that kind of relies on it. And obviously Elon Musk is not against the quote-unquote legal immigration route. H-1B visas is just one
example. We'll see if Musk can win the argument, though. There's people in the Trump administration that want to lock the Indians out too. Like, there's an active argument about it. So we'll see who wins. It's like, this is the test. Now they're in power. We'll see who wins. If Trump wins, sorry, not Trump. If Musk wins, that'll prove that, you know, basically big money and like corporate interests, you know, rule the roost and nationalists got fucked again. But if nationalism can somehow win and Musk gets cucked on the issue and they do shut down the Indians coming into America and deport the Mexicans, that's interesting too. You know, that shows that they're giving some concessions to whites. That doesn't mean that we're back though, because it's going to be a limited concession. And it's clear that if that's the case, that there's a recognition by, you know, certain other elements in the kind of, you know, in the Jewish camp in America, the Zionist camp, that we got to win white people back on side because they're our only allies. They're the only allies of Israel. And we kind of need to get them, you know, we need to like revive patriotism if we have to go and fight China. So I think, you know, and that's all part of it. But I think they're definitely going to give concessions to whites, whether the Indians come in on H-1Bs into America or not. They are going to start winding back DEI. They are going to start probably, I could see them, you know, trying to get whites back into the universities. Because in America, all the top universities, it's almost impossible to get into them if you're a white man at this point, no matter how good your scores are at school. I could see them going after that, trying to get whites back into, you know, these fields, try and like, because they need whites to build the future. Like, you can't have non-whites running all these tech companies and big business in America and expect to like just keep like dominating the world, because that's the whole reason why America got so strong in the first place. It got strong off the back of Aryan ingenuity. They brought a whole bunch of intelligent people over from Germany and from, you know, all the best parts of Europe. They brought all them over and said, here, land of opportunity, money, resources, you know, capitalism, boom, let's see what you can do. And then, you know, they built all these like incredible companies and all this tech innovation. And that drove America forward. So obviously they're going to try and bring that back because they need it, because now the Chinese have caught up because they've been, you know, dicking around for decades, you know, basically just, you know, reorganizing society around elevating all the non-whites into positions of power and influence and fucking over whites. And, you know, that's shooting themselves in the foot at a certain level. Like, they could get away with it for a while because America was so far ahead. But America's not so far ahead anymore, so they can't keep doing it and expect all of this shit to keep working out. Like, eventually the empire will crumble, the economy will crumble. And there's also like another dynamic in like, you know, economic structures called Kondratiev waves. Every like 40 to 50 years, you know, major tech innovations have to like drive the next cycle of investment. That basically, this happened in the 80s and the 90s. And the early 2000s with the tech boom. But it started in the 80s, that the beginning of this cycle, and it's kind of come to the conclusion now. And then, like, you know, the previous 40 to 50 years, it was all oil companies and automotive companies. They were the biggest companies in the world. You know, then it was all tech companies, computing companies, software companies. So like the biggest companies in America now are like Apple, Google, Meta, you know, all of these tech companies. Well, when you're if you're in investment banking and you're dumping your money in tech companies in the 80s and the 90s or the 2000s, there's a lot of money to be made because there's all these new companies popping up and turning into like multi-billion dollar companies. Well, now all the tech companies have kind of been built. And so like, if you go and buy Google stock or you go and buy, you know, Apple stock or whatever, like, it might do well, but you're not going to make insane money, because all the money's already been made. It's already established. So they need to have a new technological vista, a new paradigm that can take the economy to the next level. And obviously that's going to be AI. So now that's all the focus, all the big, you know, investors, that's all they're talking about. And they think that's going to be the magic bullet to like pull them out of an imminent economic crisis. And so we'll see. Either they do it and it works, or they fail to build AI because they've got too many Pajit software developers or something and they can't get the job done. They don't have the quality anymore that they used to have, and this whole thing falls apart. And, you know, I'm quite happy with that scenario. If they collapse the economy, it's going to be real easy to like sell. If we have like 20, 30% unemployment, it's going to be a lot easier to sell national socialism to the people. But if they can figure out how to, you know, build AI, well, that then buys the system probably another 40 years.
Well, it's going to be opportunity, like regardless of how contrived this emerging light nationalism is, there's going to be opportunity to really gain ground and reestablish a bit of a future for ourselves in our own community. What do you reckon, Tom? I know that a lot was said just then, but what's really jumping out at you?
Yeah, there's definitely an internal struggle within the Republican Party because of how American politics is structured. European politics and even Australian politics is way better in the sense that you can kind of impact the center from the outside, whereas American politics is geared that you have to be kind of inside the camp to really do anything because it's a uni party. I have noticed that there were people within the Trump administration during the handover saying that they want to put a freeze on the H-1Bs. And their argument was that we need to vet people better. We need better vetting. And then you've got Musk hitting back saying, well, this is just more red tape. This is more bureaucracy. This is what we're being employed to get rid of the red tape, just boom, full steam ahead. And so what you have is this massive clash between, I don't know if you guys checked it out and I don't know if the audience has, but it's worth just skimming through it. Trump, you know, the White House page website has been updated, and Trump basically put forward his, I don't know, it was like almost a 50-point plan as to how he's going to rebuild America. And there's some really great little things in there. And the what jumped out at me was the anti-woke stuff, you know, consolidating that women actually exist and they're a real thing. And you can't just like be a man and cut your dick off and call yourself a woman. That's actually not how it works. So that was pretty funny that has to be like instituted at a federal level in the biggest and most powerful country in the world because of how far we've fallen as a civilization. Also getting rid of DEI or definitely putting DEI on the defensive, like the affirmative action and what's openly anti-white discrimination. So everything in this 50-point plan, or almost everything, if you look at it in this 50-point plan, is to buy the empire more time. And I remember saying to you back in 2016, when we were at the pub, when we were watching Trump get not inaugurated, but when he won the election the first time, that he came across to me as like a Hadrian figure in the sense he even campaigned on building the wall. And I thought this is like kind of mid-late collapse Roman Empire, not full collapse, but like almost there. And, you know, can we change the policies? Can we change the structure of the American Empire in order to buy it more time and get a few more life cycles out of it? And it was always going to be win-win for us this election, in my opinion. If Trump lost, it's a win for us because it shows people that there is no solution within these kind of this metric. You know, it would have been good. It would have, I think, radicalized people. But then it's win-win in the sense that Trump does win. He does have a pretty good 50-point plan. We've seen this before where he has a really good plan and then he kind of actions like 30% of it. And the 30% he actions are the points in the plan that make his friends that are already billionaires more billionaire-ish, you know, near trillionaire-ish. So a huge part of the 50-point plan, I'm calling it a 50-point plan. I don't know how many points it is. I read at least 40. And a huge part of them are about national defense, about basically preventing the deterioration of the infrastructure and the physical defense of the American empire and bolstering it, which is definitely like a, you know, put pressure against China and Russia and reassert America as the dominant force in the world, which it is. It's just a decaying empire. It's not dead yet. It's just spiritually dead. And then there's like a niche policy in there, which was covered on stream probably 6 months ago, that he wants to re-beautify government buildings. So basically you can't build government buildings if they're going to be fucking new age, modern art, anti-white trash. So that was interesting. Shutting down bureaucrats, putting forward more new versions of existing laws that basically just stagnate economic growth. You know, they can't put through more regulation than they're removing. So they have to clean the system up as opposed to keep adding layers to it. So yeah, that what jumps out at me is he didn't have a very good campaign. I think it was a very mixed bag, but the situation's so bad and Joe Biden, the political theater of the United States was so horrible. It was so awful. You had like a literal dementia ridden shit the bed pedophile for the Democrats. And then you had this like kind of clown billionaire orange man, high verbal and you know, intellectual IQ, I guess. But you know, clearly just Trump is not a overly moral character. He's a merchant. Ultimately he got rich off real estate. He didn't get rich off really building a product. So he's not like a Henry Ford. He's not like an old school moneyed American. He's always been a Jew puppet, and I'm never going to get too worked up over Trump. But if you want to win an election, that's certainly one way to do it.
What you said there about him wanting to, your exact words were beautify government buildings. I presume what you mean is architecture. That's really interesting because architecture is a huge outward expression of our social and ethnic degeneration. That is to say, if the architecture is degrading, it's only an expression of the degradation of the race and the social standards, but especially the race. So to improve the quality of the architecture, you would almost need to improve the quality of the race. At the very least, you would need to raise social standards so that the quality of the race can improve. So that's definitely interesting that he made note of that specifically.
You just have to stop. In the case that America is 60% white or 55% white, whatever it's at, there's still 200 million white people that carry the capacity to beautify America. And the reason why America has deteriorated so fast isn't just because it's racially deteriorated. It's because white people have been pushed out of positions of power. And power, I mean, in a vast variants of ways, power, institutional power, cultural power. The whole country is just run by Jews and Browns. And so I saw something recently that like of the top 200 companies or whatever of Wall Street, they only 6% of employees in the last period of time, I don't know whether it was 1 year, 2 years, 4 years, but only 6% of employees were white, like of new hires, and 94% were non-white. So imagine the companies that are getting the contracts for all the great public buildings and all the great infrastructure, all these big companies that are getting these contracts. Imagine the kind of retard architects they're employing and just the talentless, beautyless, cultureless freaks that are being then educated in just retardation at university as to what the current style is. And if you want to rebuild the American empire, you need to go back to basically like a futuristic Art Decoism, like the 1930s to 1950s, well, even before the 1930s, 1910s and 20s, the Americans were doing some amazing things. They were really progressing the neoclassical ancient Greek, ancient Roman versions that lived through the, Holy Roman Empire, German Empire, British Empire, and then came across into America. The Americans really took another step with that, with the Art Deco. And, you know, that starts with things like the Empire State Building, but there's even more incredible buildings that I can't remember the exact names of because I'm not an expert on American architecture, but there's some absolutely incredible architecture, you know, post offices, train stations. A lot of them have been demolished in the United States, just like in Britain and Australia. A lot of the great architecture has been destroyed, but this was one point of 50, but it is something to be hung up on because it does show that there's depth to his policies. But yeah,
it's a rebuild. To rebuild the American empire, fundamentally, you would need to rebuild the American family, right? Those yes. individual cell yes. clusters, they would need to be healed. So no more yes. divorce, no more drugs, no more Tinder and cheating on your partner, respect yeah. for each other, that kind of
stuff. There's not much of that. There's not much of that. That kind of, those kind of reforms require a religious leader. And Trump is a merchant.
Or at leader. The very least, a spiritual leader, right?
Well, to me, it's the same thing. But yeah, it requires someone with a different caliber to be able
a
to
connection. Yeah, someone with a connection yeah. to the soul of the nation,
and,
right?
Exactly, and it requires someone that is more than actually just an individual. It actually requires a new worldview. You can't heal that with liberalism. That's one thing that liberal democracy is not going to be able to heal. They're not going to be able to heal the family because, as I wrote in my essay last night. It requires a liberal sacrifice. We have the wrong, we have liberalism inverted. We have liberalism for the state, and then we have authoritarianism against the family from the state. And the family is meant to have the opportunity to flourish. Like healthy stock people should have the freedom to flourish and not be poisoned by the state and pointed guns at by the state. And anyone that in America that thinks that that's not happening because they've got a Second Amendment is delusional. The state is pointing guns at them and saying, you will accept our ultimate authority. And you see that with people getting their guns taken off them all the time with red flag laws if they've got a, if they get a little bit too uppity. So what Western civilization needs is a complete spiritual rebirth. Trump's not capable of doing that. So that's why you have quite niche right-wing commentators in our scenes saying to everyone, you know, this is blackpilling, don't get your hopes up. And they're kind of right, like they are right, but the reason why I'm ignoring them at the moment isn't because they're incorrect. They are correct. I'm just ignoring them because let's just have the party and then move on with the business. Like, let's just have a day or two where we're like, this is hilarious, this is funny, let's see where this goes. And then we can go back to the drawing board once the party's over and go, okay, how are we going to modify our politics going into 2025 and 2026? Not really politics. Our politics are always going to stay the same. But how are we going to modify our strategy? How does this impact us and the environment that we're operating in? Are we in a higher threat environment or a lower threat environment? Well, that answer is pretty easy. But how do we adapt to this new environment? And what are the areas that we need to maybe cut loose? And what are the areas we need to strengthen and fortify?
We can definitely capitalize on the morale boost. There's going to be a morale boost. There's going to be a new energy out there, a wave of energy that we can really ride to new heights. So, you know, in terms of how the average person's going to be affected, how the average person's going to be feeling, they're going to be feeling a little more confident to support a more nationalist worldview. So there's capitalization there.
That's definitely true. I think there's a few things. Like, number one, the notion of freedom of speech is only strengthening and bolstering in its value. And the conservative movement in general is now being held to account in its internal culture by a more radical internal element. It has a more radical culture. Like, think about from when Trump ran to now, the kind of discourse that you see within, you know, mainstream right-wing commentary in the United States. And it's a complete world away from where it was, you know, 10 years ago. Like, now it's like literally borderline white nationalist. And that doesn't always translate to policy, but it does translate to pressure. So what we need as nationalists from the conservative movement, if we're going to get anything from them, is for them to at least defend our freedom to operate. And in America, they've got that better defended than in, because they've got the First Amendment and than we have in a lot of these other countries. But nevertheless, the fact that that is strengthening and the American conservative movement and right-wing conversation is so impactful to the broader English-speaking world and Western world in general, we have to triple down upon that. And we've been doing that already in recent, you know, months here in Australia, because the concept of freedom of speech is growing in its popularity and in its strength and in its gravitas, whilst at the same time, the Australian political class are actually out of touch. They still think that we're still in 2019 or 2020 or 2021. They haven't realized, they haven't come to terms with the fact the rules have changed in political culture, and we can catch them out because we've seen it before. They've adapted to it And we can then now make some actual gains, like metapolitically, culturally, with the people, because the people are now, you know, are shifted to the right. Like, you know, we're going to bridge to a discussion about Australia Day. That's an issue where, like, the establishment is completely out of touch. Like, there was a poll that came out that said, you know, should we change the date of Australia Day? Should we keep it what it is? And what they said is that there's been an over 10% increase in support for keeping the date what it is. Now, like 70% of Australians want to keep it a date that it is. The majority of young people now are saying they want to keep it what it is, which hasn't been the case for recent polls in recent years. And only like 14% of people want to change the date. Yet pretty much all the political establishment thinks that the date should be changed and that it's horrible and that we should be ashamed of Australia Day. But like the entire like population, like Australia's about 70% white, and about 70% of people are saying they don't want to change the date. So basically the center, the normies, are on the side of us. And the same is true on free speech. The same is true on a lot of things. And it's becoming true even on the immigration issues and borderline on identity issues. So we're making a lot of gains in terms of the normalization of our discourse and also the defensibility of our position. So that means that not only are people more moralized about politics, but they're more open-minded to actually hearing our perspective, and they're more emboldened to actually defend us, even if they don't agree with us, we're a bit too radical for them or whatever. And we need to be defended on the grounds of, okay, well, I might not agree with them, but they have free speech, or the system isn't treating them fairly, even if I don't agree with them. We need that kind of thing from like the masses if we're going to succeed here and get off the ground. That's kind of step one. So we've got that, which is, I think, a benefit. The second thing is that, you know, Trump will do some things that are good, but ultimately it won't be enough. It won't be anywhere near enough to like fix the deep structural issues with our civilization, frankly, to put it that way. And so this is only going to improve our position, because before, if you have like a left-wing government and a left-wing paradigm and full wokeness, full political correctness, retardation, and we come along and say, well, this is ridiculous. Well, conservatives can say, okay, but you guys are way too radical. Like, we can oppose this with our ideology, and we could clean up this mess that the left is making, and we could fix everything if just we got in power and we could have our ideas. Well, now they're going to get their way, and everyone is going to see that it's not a solution. So that legitimates, I think, our criticism a lot more to people to say, hey, look, the conservatives got what they wanted. It's not good enough. So you're going to have to come listen to our message now, because, you know, it's going to vindicate us. I think that's going to be true for a lot of people. And the other thing that I said as well is that look at when the system started making concessions to women with feminism or to blacks with like, you know, kind of black identity politics or, you know, to other minorities, to gays. Did that pacify feminists? Did that pacify gay rights activists or like, you know, pro like the gay community or whatever? Did that pacify blacks? No, it only emboldened them to demand even more. The more they got, the more that they want, the more that they expect. And I think the same is going to be true for whites. Like if the system is going to give whites 30% of what we want, as opposed to like zero, I think that's going to embolden whites to ask for at least 60% of what we want, or 70%. Whereas if you're getting zero, 30% sounds like a good deal. Once you get used to getting 30%, it's no longer a good deal. That's the new normal. So I think it's actually a good thing that Trump has won, and it's a good thing that the system is making these concessions. Also, it shows that the Jews aren't infallible. Some people in this movement think that the Jews are just like almost like God, like they're completely in control of everything, and they're like just playing this like game of 5D chess and controlling everything, and we're just dumb goys. They're showing some weakness. You know, Elon Musk throws a Roman, the ADL have to cower. Now, I know Elon Musk is in the pocket of the Jews, but also the thing is that the Jews kind of need him. The Jews kind of like need Trump to go up there and make some concessions to whites. They kind of need whites to be kind of like brought onto the team. Like if the Jews want to quadruple down with like hysteria and demands and offer us nothing, it's not going to work for them. And some of them haven't realized that, like the Melbourne Jewish community hasn't realized that. And we can take advantage of their idiocy and their hysteria in the media to make them look like idiots to the Australian people. But there's some Jews that are smarter and that have wised up, and they're going to take the edge off a lot of things, and they're going to give us some of what we want. And what that shows, you could say, oh, that's pacification. That's bad. That's going to lull people back to sleep. The other way to look at it is that it shows that they're actually, it's showing weakness. When your enemy shows weakness, that's actually a good thing. When the enemy is making concessions to you, that's a good thing. You shouldn't be upset about it. You should be upset at people who think that taking those concessions is enough. You should be upset they're not demanding more. You should be pushing them to demand more, and you should be pushing them to a more radical position. But you should also recognize, hey, like, we actually have some strength. Like, white people as a collective, we have leverage. We have some power. We're not really using it anywhere near to the extent that we could, but we have it. And so we shouldn't be so fucking demoralized. We shouldn't be so pathetic and be like, it's all over, the Jews run everything, and develop this kind of like helpless stance. Like, that helplessness is fucking poison. We need to have optimism. We need to have boldness if we're going to win. So.
Yeah, well, 30% of what I want is Australia Day, the way I remember it as a kid. Everyone's celebrating. Everyone's happy about it. Barbecues, shows, fireworks. That's 30% of what I want. 60% of what I want is white Australia. And I would say 100% of what I want is probably not legal for me to say.
So, Blair, let's talk about, because you're going to be at a rally at Rod Laver Arena. Now, there was an advertisement for this rally put on by the National Workers Alliance that was going around, and it originally said 4 p.m., but I believe that the time has been moved to midday. Is that correct?
Yeah, I saw that on Notice and News, and I've heard it along the grapevine. It's going to be a lunchtime event. Now, there's a couple of Australia Day events going on, which is great, but the one that I'll be attending, the one that I'm endorsing, is going to be outside Rod Laver Arena in Melbourne. I've checked out the terrain. I've had a look at the area where the rally is going to be. I took some time off to go and do that a couple of days ago. It's a good spot for an event. There's some high grounds. It's a nice open space as well, but not too open. And there's plenty of ways in and out. So I think it'll be a great day. It'll be a successful event. There's the chance that there'll be some clashes with some leftist characters, but you shouldn't be worried about that. There's going to be enough people there that you'll be in good numbers, and people will be looking out for each other there. I know that only Australian flags. I'm sorry.
I think realistically, the police will probably try and keep
there'll be a lot of cops there.
Separated from the nationals. Also, it's important to point out the Australian Open is happening, so there's going to be all these tennis fans there going to watch the tennis. So it's an event you shouldn't be too worried about showing up to, because you could just be a tennis fan that just happens to be walking past. And
exactly. There's going to be a lot of public there, a lot of curious public walking by, which is, well, what's more curious about that still is I noticed there was an article put out by ABC recently, an opinion piece by a couple of law professors or legal experts, suggesting that people could be barred from entering events if they display too much national symbology at those events on Australia Day. Basically, they're trying to shut Australia Day down inside the Australian Open and other major sporting events or whatever's going on around the country, which will be great for us because we're standing right outside the gates. So anyone who's barred entry because they're too proud of their country, join us. We'll be right there. But yeah, Rod Laver Arena, this coming Sunday, Jan 26th at lunchtime. I'll be there, and I hope to see everybody there. I've got a couple more little promo clips and that, some more content to get up there to make sure everybody gets the message. So that'll be happening over the next couple of days. So yeah, that's where I'll be on Sunday, and I'll see you guys there. You're watching this. I'll see you there. I hope to see you there.
Yo, everyone in Melbourne should get down to it. I don't know of any events happening in Sydney or in Brisbane, but I haven't spent a lot of time looking into it. But I encourage everyone, wherever you are in Australia, to get out and celebrate Australia Day proudly and openly, because it's just so important. Like, it's not just about the day. It has like a deeper significance. Like, this is a celebration of the Aryan conquest of this continent. You know, the lefties call it.
Not just that, but what you say, Joel, something you say is really important, and I'm actually going to bring it up on the day. Hmm. We need to remember our team, the team that we fought for, the original team that built Australia, the team that they've convinced us to forget about, which is our team, the white Australian workers. Everybody else is fighting for their team. We need to remember that we have a team too, and we've got to start looking out for our own interests. And one of the ways we can start doing that is to reinvigorate our pride in our country on Australia Day. like to make that the datum point from which we rise again, so to speak. I think that can happen. I think Australia Day is a good day to do that.
We do a lot of protesting, and protesting is good, but celebrating is just as important. You know, celebrating is very important because celebrating is about declaring victory. And we need to, you know, basically, like, we've won on this issue of Australia Day. The left have tried to throw the kitchen sink at it, and we've actually won. Like, the public opinion has swung back in our direction. Companies that were trying to go to basically memory hole Australia Day or quash Australia Day are being forced to celebrate it against their will and affirm it against their will. And, you know, the attempts by the enemy to attack it have only made Australians love Australia Day more and feel more defensive about defending our national identity. And that's actually a fantastic thing. It's a great thing. So we need to declare victory over that, because that is a victory against the demoralization campaign by the enemy to destroy our identity. But also we need to declare victory over this continent. Like, this continent was founded and settled by our people. We've got a lot to celebrate, a proud history, a beautiful country. And it's important to celebrate our heritage and who we are as a people, you know, rather than just always being like protesting against this thing is happening and that thing is happening and this whites are the victim in this way and that way and so on. Whites also need to be victors. And that also needs to be,
it's a flex. Australia Day is a big flex, and it should be. We've got plenty to flex about.
Yeah, exactly. And there's something I want to bring up. You know, maybe Tom should talk about this because he's more abreast of the situation, but in Adelaide, there's going to be an Australia Day march as well. And our friends and associates over in Adelaide are going to be there. But some of our friends and associates over in Adelaide, they pulled out the Mass Deportations Now banner over a highway. They had a cool hype vid about it, and it caused some controversy over in Adelaide, you know, a week or so ago. It was all over the news in Adelaide. The police ended up raiding these people's homes, or some of the people's homes that were there, and trying to go after them legally. And they found this obscure law from years ago that, like, no one has been tried under for like decades. That basically, there's a law in the books in South Australia that if you have an article of disguise and you're suspected of being in the commission of a crime, they can charge you with a crime of possessing that article of disguise itself. And they've tried to use this law against the boys. I don't think it'll stand up in court because they weren't about to rob a bank or something. That's what that law is for. Like, if you've got a balaclava and you're about to go rob a bank or, you know, do some other kind of criminal activity like violent crime, that's what that's about. Standing on a bridge with a banner is not a crime. But nevertheless, they're trying to use this law against them. It will get chucked in court, I guarantee it. But in the meantime, they've then tried to give them bail conditions that prevent them from celebrating Australia Day, like literally, which is insane. So it's like this like police operation to use like legal warfare to prevent nationalists from celebrating their national holiday. But Tom probably has more to say on this.
Yeah, I have a lot to say on this subject, more so than the Donald Trump subject, because it's most relevant to us here in Australia. Our national holiday, if you think about it, is a form of secular religion. So we were founded as a relatively Christian, white Christian society, but we always had that Protestant separation of church and state. And there's many dates in our calendar that are significant for specifically Christian reasons or religious reasons. But there are also a lot of dates in our calendar that are really unique and native to the foundation and creation and maintenance of Australia as a folk, as a people. So you have things like Anzac Day, you have Remembrance Day, although that is across the Anglosphere and France as well. But you have things like Australia Day, and a people need to have a national identity. And just like a family may have a Christmas or an important birthday or an important date that that individual family will celebrate every year and have a big barbecue and have that kind of catharsis experience. The letting of the hair down as a family is important, to break bread together, to feast together. It's important for the family to do that to carry on into the new year. And likewise, as a nation, we have to do that. And what the government and these left-wing traitors are trying to do is they're trying to stop Australian people from healing every year. Every year, we need to come together as a national identity and put everything that we've had against each other, whether, you know, again, as a liberal democracy, it's meant to be about, doesn't matter whether you're liberal, Labor, One Nation, whatever, that's irrelevant. Richmond Football Club, Hawthorn Football Club, irrelevant. New South Wales, Victoria, state of origin, irrelevant. Union, not union, blue collar, white collar, doesn't matter. The whole point of Australia Day is that it sees through class, it sees through caste, it sees through all of these things. And as a folk, as a family, as an extended family, the good of us and the bad of us all come together. We forget all the bad and we remember the good. And the good is that we are a single people, that we're not Chinese, we're not Eskimos, we're not, you know, this or that. We are Australians. We have an identity, a culture, a language, and this is our day that we celebrate and have a party together and then move on into the next year together, and we can go back to fighting each other later. But this is the day that we remember we're together. And if we don't have that, we're open to attack from the enemy. That's a fact. Every nation, every folk, every family needs to have something that ties them together, that they come together. And that's why Australia Day has been under attack for so long, because the communists and the traitors that are trying to destroy Australia, that are trying to spiritually weaken us, they know this. That's why they're attacking it. What I'll say about other Australia Day events, I just saw a comment from the British Australian community, which is a lobby group for British Australians or Anglo-Saxon Australians that works very hard to represent and try to put forward a case for white people within the diversity of multiculturalism. We always hear about the Jewish lobby and the Chinese lobby and, you know, the African Australians and this Australian and that Australian, but we don't really hear so much about the actual majority of Australians, which are Anglo-Celtic or Anglo-Saxon descent people. And so they're an organization that works very hard to try to put that on the map. And I saw a comment from them just then that said that they'll be hosting barbecues in Sydney and in Brisbane. So I suggest that everyone that is watching the stream that's in Australia that isn't going to be at an event with their family, if they don't have a family tradition, if they are going to go to a public event, I suggest that they do everything they can to support these smaller organizations and grow and become a part of them. There is going to be an event, of course, that Blair is involved with in Melbourne, and we're going to be supporting that as well to a capacity. There is also, I think, an event made by the establishment that's trying to detract people from the event Blair is involved in. I think the system has worked out that if they don't put up a false opposition, if they don't put up an event themselves, if they say, well, there is no Australia Day celebration this year, then it leaves a power vacuum. It leaves an open space for real grassroots leadership, real grassroots community to be built with the correct principles, without welcome to countries.
This is why Sky News was plugging a different event. That's what you're saying, yes. Right?
The Conservatives are putting on an event, but what's interesting is that it's not in the city itself. They're too cowardly to put it on in the city. Then they're dragging people to St. Kilda, I think.
Yes.
Somewhere south of the city.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't announce this event until after Blair and Blair's colleagues announced that they were going to do their event. Now, if Blair and co. didn't announce that, I don't think there would be another event. This has been whipped together in order to detract genuine nationalist grassroots people getting involved in celebrating Australia Day and saying, well, actually, let's contain them. Let's build a containment rally for those people that make sure that these people don't hear anything that they're not meant to hear. Because if you go to Blair's Australia Day rally, you might actually hear the truth. Whereas if you go to this other Australia Day rally, you will hear Australia Day light. You will hear the halfway point. You'll hear the compromise. You'll hear what they want you to be caught up in if you're not if you're not going to be a rabidly anti-Australia. You know, they want to catch you in that next catchment. So that's going on as well. And as Joel has mentioned, we have colleagues, of course, activists in South Australia and WA, and both of them have been doing activism, just as we have in Melbourne, rallies and demonstrations. And they did one about 2 weeks ago, and the police have arrested about half of them and have threatened them with prison. They've bailed them under the condition that they don't attend any Australia Day celebrations. And so this is an absolute travesty of the Australian Constitution. It's completely un-Australian. It's outright treason from the South Australian police to be enforcing a political agenda of people that hate Australia and hate Australia Day to try to stop nationalists from publicly celebrating their national holiday. And so if you are in Adelaide, if you are in South Australia, I encourage you to be in the city on Australia Day and look out for an Australia Day rally held by our colleagues in South Australia, because they need all the support they can get. They're getting harassed by the police. They're being attacked by the police, and they're being given unconstitutional bail conditions and being given false charges as well. So as Joel mentioned, this article of disguise law, the last time it was used was someone in 1991 dressed up as a woman to try to murder a rapist that had raped his wife. And they were unsuccessful with convicting him for attempted murder and instead managed to get him on wearing an article of disguise. And before that, it's just burglary charges. So it's not a charge that has anything to do with political protesting. You're allowed to politically protest in Australia, and you're allowed to politically protest wearing a mask. They haven't brought in new laws to change that yet. And so what they're doing is they're digging deep. They've got obviously consultants to dig deep into laws written in 1953, in this case, to basically stop peaceful public celebration of our national holiday. So wherever you are, Melbourne, Brisbane, Sydney, Adelaide, even Tasmania, even Perth, try to find something in public, bring an Australian flag, and let's celebrate our national day. And I'll be with you in spirit, and so will Blair and Joel.
Yeah, so yeah, if you're in Adelaide, I don't know exactly where, but I will find out from Adelaide Associates. Give some instructions if you're in Adelaide.
When we know where it is, we'll try and make a public post.
Yeah, and if anyone is doing an Australia Day event in Sydney or Brisbane,
we'll share.
And let me know if you guys, obviously, if you're nationalists or nationalist adjacent, let me know. And I'll be happy to also promote that to followers, and try and get your mates, family, whatever, and get to one of these events in one of our capital cities and celebrate the day, because I'm so sick of Australia Day being about these fucking communists and abos marching through the street doing invasion day. Fuck you. You know, the people are tired of this shit. It's time to steamroll over these cunts and assert ourselves and celebrate our fucking country, celebrate who we are. And, fuck them. I think everyone shares that sentiment, and I'm looking forward to them making an ass of themselves to the Australian people again, and getting up to their typical antics and only radicalizing the Australian people more in our direction, pushing them more in our direction. But yeah, get your family to celebrate. Make sure that Australia Day goes hard, that it's one of the big days of the calendar in your family, in your friendship group. We've got to bring it back. It's been too dim for years. When I was young, I remember when I was a kid, Australia Day was always massive. It was like one of the absolute like highlights of the year. Everyone would get on the piss. Everyone would send it. It was the best. And it would always be celebrated in like different sporting events, and there'd be big parades through the cities put on by the government. And it used to be like just a really sick thing. And now as Blair's video mentioned, you know, in Melbourne, and this is also true in other cities, they've, you know, they shut down the Australia Day like parades in a lot of our cities. They shut them down during COVID and they're refusing to bring them back. In Melbourne, they literally have a Jewish guy in charge of Australia Day that's refusing to do the Australia Day parades, and he controls the Australian of the Year awards and just hands them all to non-whites. It's a fucking joke. It used to be like, you know, it wasn't anywhere near as zog back like, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. It's fucked now. So we need to bring it back. We need to reestablish some patriotism, some pride. And, you know, if you, by the way, as well, another thing, I was inspired by my dad. I remember like last year, my dad got really pissed off about the whole like Woolworths refusing to sell Australia Day merchandise thing. So he went and bought a giant flagpole, the biggest one he could get, and put the biggest Australian flag he could get on the flagpole. And then he went to all of his neighbors and like implored them to do the same. And everyone on the street except one, you know, Muslim family are white. And so all the white families have giant flagpoles with Australian flags at the front now, except for the one Muslim family. And they're just mogging them. Like you can see who the odd people out are. And, you know, that's a little expression of white identity. It's a little bit of white solidarity. So, you know, our identity is under attack. That should only make us triple down on our identity and being proud of it. So, you know, celebrate it. Get the Aussie flags out. You know, get the patriotard chungus to the max. Have Land Down Under, Men at Work, Greatest Hits albums playing. You know, send it. Enjoy the day. It's very important. But, yeah, if you can get out to one of these events in the city, please do. And we've got to, like, mog it. Like, in the next 5 years, our objective should be to grow Australia Day rallies in every city of Australia so big that they end up getting bigger than the fucking Abbo Communist Invasion Day rallies, and we just start overpowering them and taking our cities back on Australia Day. That should be one of our objectives. And I think it's a very achievable objective. But it starts this year.
Yeah. I was just reading. It was just brought to my attention. I hope it's okay that I changed the subject. You know, we talked about the British Broadcasting Corporation in Wales, UK.
Yeah.
Had apparently secretly recorded me saying some edgy stuff. Well, the article about that's just been published. And I was just reading through it. And what I said is like, I've like perfectly corked the edges of my statement in the statement, which I suppose is why the broadcaster wouldn't contextualize my what they claimed I was saying. I asked for a full transcript of the conversation so I could understand the context, and they refused to give it to me. They just kept asking, do you deny it? Do you deny it? And I'm like, well, no, I don't deny anything. I'm not answering questions until I see the footage, I hear the audio recording, or I see a transcript. So they just didn't reply to me, right? But apparently I've said in relation to Violene White, if you guys remember who Violene White was, she was the grandmother stabbed to death by African kids up in Queensland in a car park in front of her grandchild because they just wanted to take her car for a joyride. And one of the kids who stabbed her, I think the actual kid who stabbed her, maybe it was only one of the kids, but it was a group of kids. Maybe it was only one kid who actually did stab her. That African kid was released on bail and has now committed more offences while on bail. But anyway, in relation to that stabbing, I said here, the only way to effectively respond to a crime they've committed as heinous as that is probably, you know, I probably shouldn't say this on stream actually, but you can read the article. You can read the article. And you can see why they didn't give me the
full statement. I'm going to read it. Statement. I'm going to read the quote. The quote goes hard. If you don't want to read it, I'll read it. Do you
want
to read it?
You can read it if you want. You can read it if you want, yeah.
All right, so this is what Blair said.
But read the full quote. Don't. You got to read the full quote.
Yeah, I'm reading the full quote. So Blair's sitting there having a meal, and he said, an old lady.
You can bring it up on the screen if you want. Do you want to do that? Screen share the
bad tape. This thing that you sent me is about. Let me just read it, all right? What you said was, an old lady was stabbed to death by a gang of African kids. When you look at the way things happen in Africa, the only language they understand is violence. The only way to effectively respond to a crime that they've committed as heinous as what I described is to literally skin them. You hang a few of their bodies up across some traffic lights or something. Just theoretically, of course. I can't condone it.
But I'm just staring at my
like you said that shit on the show like multiple times. Like that's such a Blairism. Like you love skinning people for some reason.
The point I was making, like the essence of the statement is jail is obviously not a deterrent for these people. That we need to something more extreme needs to be of consequence because they're not scared of going to jail. It's not enough. So that was the point of the conversation I was having. But the article's available and you can read the full thing. It's pretty bad. Like, it's just an effort to try to get Patriotic Alternative up in England banned, or new laws are made specifically to shut them down or something. But they had some spy on them for about a year, secretly filming people and filming private conversations. And all they got after a whole year is some fragmented pieces of conversation that might be a little bit edgy. It's hardly anything. It's a bit of a non-story, really. And Mark Collett has already been on or been into the studio with the British Broadcasting Corporation in Wales, done his own interview with them and kind of pulled apart all the evidence they claim to have and explained it away. So you can find that on my Telegram as well if you're interested in this story. But yeah, that's the big reveal about the secret recording of me.
I was hoping for something more juicy.
When I read the whole thing, I'm like, I corked the edges of my statement myself, which I tend to do when I'm saying edgy shit. That's why it surprised me that they thought they had anything extreme in the first place. I'm usually pretty good at using the right language. So turns out they didn't have anything at all. So
yeah. It's an optical W from Blair. You played it like a charm. Your statements are completely valid. Here on the show, we support legal mass executions of these non-white criminal grubs, whether they be the Paki rape gangs, whether they be these, violent black criminals, you know, murdering people in home invasions and so on. We need to bring back the death penalty. This is not a terroristic statement. This is a statement of sound government policy. Pretty much for all of human history, and in most countries in the world today, they have the death penalty. To have a functional society, you need to execute, do due process, but you need to execute the violent, the extremely violent, not people that get into a fight at the pub. We're not talking about that kind of violence. We're talking about like serious, murder, just like, basically savage criminality, unspeakable acts that destroy lives and that are just heinous, and that, these people can't be reintroduced back into society. Now, they shouldn't be in our countries, these Africans, these Arabs and so on. There's a reason why Europeans don't behave like this at anything like the same rates as these other savage races that they're importing. It's because in Europe, for thousands of years, we executed everyone who acted like that. And so we just kind of like cleaned them out of our gene pool generation after generation. That's what happens when you have a civilization. It's the same with the Asians. That's why the East Asians are also not as predisposed to these kinds of violent crimes, because they've had a civilization over there for thousands of years and they've executed their, low IQ, anti-social minority.
There's remnants of that level of severity still in Japan. I'm pretty sure if you steal anything in Japan, even if it's like $50 worth of stuff, you go to jail for like 4 years. So no one steals in Japan because it's just not worth it.
They have much harsher penalties for a lot of crimes in these East Asian countries, which are obviously good. And we support these kinds of things. But when it comes to gang rape, when it comes to stabbing people with in home invasions, or chopping people up with machetes or whatever,
stabbing grandmothers, defenseless old ladies,
like people like that can't be reintroduced into society, and deporting them is wrong because they shouldn't get to live after doing these kinds of acts. They need to be killed by the state, simple as. And you're an absolute retard if you have a different opinion. This is actually the sensible, sane opinion. If you have a different opinion, you're actually a far left extremist. You are a complete nutcase if you believe that we should just tolerate this kind of criminal, like it's not delinquency, this kind of heinous criminality in our society. I mean, look at this story, by the way. And this isn't as extreme as some other things, but this was in the Noticer story yesterday from Melbourne. Young lifeguard bashed by gang of Afghan teens at a Melbourne swimming pool. This happened in Narre Warren. I'll read this out and we'll get your reaction from you guys. By the way, Noticer.news, absolutely killing it as always. I saw this story blow up, and it was reported in the mainstream media. They didn't mention that it was Afghans. They just said youths. Anyway, a lifeguard at a public swimming pool in Melbourne has been brutally beaten by a gang of Afghan teenagers in a shocking attack in front of families and children. The 19-year-old was attacked while on duty at Casey Aquatic and Recreation Center in Narre Warren just before 6 p.m. on Saturday evening, leaving him requiring hospital treatment for upper body injuries. This is in like the southeast of Melbourne. The large group of male youths set upon the lifeguard after he told one of them to stop doing flips into the pool dangerously close to other swimmers, including children, Nine News reported. He was then headbutted, kicked, and punched, leaving his lifeguard uniform spattered with blood. The group of at least nine then fled the scene and are still on the run. And as far as I can tell, the last update I saw, there hasn't been any arrests yet. Locals said the attackers were teenagers of Afghani background who were known for making trouble in the area. Here's some quotes from locals. To the Afghani teenagers who bashed a helpless lifeguard at KCARC today just for asking you to follow simple rules, it just shows the nature of your upbringing. This is a local resident on a local Facebook group.
Shows the nature of the race, yeah, rather than the upbringing.
Of course, but it says here, you quote, you create conflicts in your country and you come here seeking refuge only to create such problems for the country that accepted you. I have witnessed them at the Cranbourne pools abusing and trying to intimidate an elderly woman because she entered the same pool as them, wrote another. From what we have seen with our own eyes, some of the Afghan kids are absolutely putrid, said a third. I mean, this guy's cooking. Walking through the shopping centers with machetes, walking the streets of Cranbourne, Clyde, and Narre Warren with machetes, robbing stores and thinking it's hilarious.
This is base news, man. Is this Noticer?
Yeah, this is Noticer quoting. Because right, only the Noticer would actually do real journalism and figure out what locals are saying.
True.
Just 5 days ago, the swimming pool put out a post on social media asking visitors to treat lifeguards and swim teachers with respect. So this is obviously a perennial problem. According to the 2021 census, 3.5% of Narre Warren's population was born in Afghanistan. So this is disgusting. This is not far from, you know, this is our city. This is our hood. And I want the names. So if you figure out who these people are, I want their fucking names. And I'm going to go to the Department of Homeland Affairs where those... Remember all those like Sri Lankans and shit that were, you know, demanding permanent visas now and all this kind of shit. And we went down and we did our fuck off for full rallies to, you know, expose them and troll them. I'm going to go down to the Department of Homeland Affairs and maybe some of my friends will as well. And we're going to go and demand that they deport these cunts back to Afghanistan. Because they're all clearly like, no one wants them here. And I'm sure the vast majority of the Australian people will be behind me on that. So if you live in that area, you know who these people are. Maybe they went to your school. Maybe they're your neighbors. You know them in some capacity. Tell the police because they need to be arrested. But also tell me because we need these names documented as best we can so that we can put pressure on the government to get these cunts out of our country. And I want the government to respond. You know, I don't think that they're going to listen to me and do what I ask, but I want them to say, no, we're keeping them here. And I want the system to expose how much contempt it has for white Australians. The position of mass deportations is not an extremist position. It is a common sense position, just like the position of executing, you know, seriously heinous violent criminals is also a reasonable position. The extremists are the anti-deportationists, the people that think this once great country that was, you know, say, well, you know, 20 years ago, there wasn't any fucking Afghans in Narre Warren and it was completely safe. You go to the pools, it was all just white kids playing, white families. Nothing like this would ever happen. White Australians don't bash lifeguards for making reasonable requests. These people need to be sent back. And Australia will no longer exist as a serious, beautiful country that it once was, a country that is civilized, that has a society that's actually good to live in, that's safe for women and children and families and the elderly until these cunts are sent back where they fucking belong. It's as simple as that. That's the common sense position. The idea that white Australians just have to shut up and accept this shit, that's the extremist position.
Yeah, I was thinking about going for a swim. We'll see how well these guys can fight when it's a real man, not a... I mean, I'm sure... I think he was 19, so it's pretty hard when you get mobbed.
Yeah, they pick their targets, don't they? That's so true. Yeah. They pick their targets.
If I go down there with a few of the boys and we go for a swim, you know, maybe we'll get the Aussie flag tattoos on our cheeks. You know, I'll bring a... Like, Jacob can wear a T-shirt that says, what is it, ECU on it.
You know, ethnic cleansing Nala. Unit.
Ethnic save, cleansing unit, yeah.
We're going to save
Nala. We grew here, you flew here.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think maybe that could be a good policy as well. Maybe we should visit Casey Aquatic Center and have like a boys' day there and take a group photo of all the boys having a swim there. Keeping the swimming pool safe for white Australian kids.
Count me in for that. Count me in for that. Yeah. I'll be there with bells on.
We'll get Cottrell there. Cottrell in the Speedos. You know, it could be a day.
Well, if they want to fight as a gang, well, maybe they can try fighting a gang and see how it goes for them.
Yeah, somehow I don't think they're going to be very noisy while we're there.
Yeah, rather than picking on like some lifeguard that's just there to do his job and protect, you know, kids playing in the pool. I mean, what's, you know, what's funny?
They weren't very noisy during Cronulla, were they?
Yeah. You know what's crazy? They
shut up and pissed off Quicksmart then.
Is that the police didn't show up in time. I saw the video of them attacking the guy. And I mean, you know, when police want to be somewhere, they can be there in less than 5 minutes. I mean, when we did that protest at in the city, it is the city, so they're there pretty quick. But some of those police officers had rocked up. They weren't even from that unit. They were from different units, and they rocked up really quick, within a couple of minutes. And likewise, you know, geez, I don't want to give away too much information, but yeah, there's been times where police come really quickly, don't they? When it's a white guy involved. And I think if we go down to Casey Aquatic Center, I think the police will be there within probably less than 5 minutes just to keep an eye on us. They'll just stand there in their body armor with their guns on their hips while we're just swimming and enjoying the water slide. But they're not going to be there when we're not there and it's just Arabs taking over. And that's just the whole anarcho-tyranny of the situation. It's it's anarchy for the non-whites. They can just form gangs, form groups, do whatever they want. Police do fuck all. But as soon as white people start grouping together, the police go fucking meltdown. Yeah.
Well, they had like 20 detectives running all over Melbourne trying to arrest me the other day for doing a speech in front of a banner. Yeah. They can't find these Afghans that are bashing fucking lifeguards in front of families. I mean, fuck Victoria Police. I mean, you cunts should all head. I mean, I say it all the time, but they should hang their heads in shame. Like, you're a fucking joke. You're an absolute fucking joke.
They can't even protect their own shrine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But you can imagine the media response if you did go down to those pools. The pools would probably close and they'd send everyone home and, you know, Nazis ruin fun for everyone. And when you go there to protect people, and it's, you'd probably get that kind of report. But who cares, right?
What about a banner that says, "Do you want Cronulla 2.0? Yeah.
Well,
but now the comment section was based. The comment section was great. Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, the comment section for that notice article was just, I noticed just hundreds of people, not just the notice article, but the Channel 7 comment section after you got in there, Joel, and ratioed them. I noticed they shut comments off after about 90 or 100 comments. And I scrolled through and there was not a single person being a left-wing woke faggot. Everyone was just in there like, you know, basically, we're sick of these people coming to our country and taking advantage of our good nature. That was the general consensus, which is the majority. That's not even the majority. It's the super majority. It's probably well over 70%, 80% of white Australians are just sick of our good nature and our nice country that we've made just being taken advantage of. Oh, look at these two. Fucking hell.
This is the mayor and deputy mayor. Look at these cunts.
Of what? Of Melbourne?
No, of Casey.
The area. Oh, right. Like, yeah. Melinda Ambrose, deputy mayor, and Stefan Kuman.
You think you'd least have to be able to fight to be a mayor? You know, like,
that will be a policy in the ethno state, Blair. Don't worry.
Yeah, you'd have to be able to fight. Like, yeah, I don't know. Soft hands, man. You can't trust a man with soft hands.
Correct.
Or any woman, for that matter.
Well, you can trust them, but they shouldn't be in charge of, like, cities. That's just ridiculous.
No.
In charge of a city that they could never have built, you know? Like, if you can't work, if you don't know what it's like to dig, then what business do you have leading or administering men that dig? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Need some experience in that field.
You got to do your time on the shovel and amongst other things. But yeah, what's next on the topic? We've covered most of the bases, haven't we?
We've had a good show so far. It's been a good one, yeah.
Another notice or article. This is the last thing I wanted to cover. I spoke about this on social media and a lot of people saw it. New South Wales Premier blames hate speech for anti-Semitic attacks and vows to strengthen laws. So there's been like a wave of, in Sydney, there's been a wave of people spraying up swastikas and just graffitiing on synagogues across Sydney. And I don't know if it's the Muslims. I don't know if it's a Jewish false flag, combination of the two. I don't know. But whatever the case may be, it's been happening a lot recently. There's been quite a few of these. And the Jews have been freaking out in the media like as if it's a terrorist attack, like as if someone spray painting something on a wall is, you know, like tantamount to like being like car bombed or something. But anyway, so apparently because
they're getting a result from that, though. If they can get the result that they want from some graffiti, then of course they're going to go for that. The government is stupid enough to be giving them what they want for such a low-tier crime that really doesn't have anything to do with violence, you know? So it's the Jewish version of rioting, I've said before, is to make a huge deal out of nothing and see what they can get from it. And the government keeps caving to it. It's embarrassing.
Yeah, basically, it's a fucking whingeocracy. It's a complainocracy, and that's why the Jews are running it. But anyway, look, here we go. I'll read the article, and then we can discuss it. New South Wales Premier Chris Minns has vowed to strengthen quote-unquote hate speech laws and declared that multiculturalism is, quote, not up for debate, sparking a furious backlash. Mr. Minns said on Sunday that making New South Wales anti-vilification laws even harsher would be one of the first items on his agenda when Parliament resumes next month, claiming that hate speech was responsible for a series of alleged anti-Semitic firebomb and graffiti attacks in Sydney. Quote, I've become increasingly of the view that the initial spark isn't someone going to a synagogue or a house and lighting a match. The initial spark is hate speech in our community, he said. Our government is going to make the decision soon, a difficult decision, but the right one, to strengthen hate speech laws in New South Wales so that if someone is preaching hatred in the community, it doesn't manifest itself to, 2 or 3 months later in a firebombing or an attack or something worse. Now,
hang on, just to clarify, what he's insinuating there, what he's insinuating is speech is akin to terrorism. That's what he's trying to say. Certain types of speech probably are the spark for political violence, and so they're going to criminalize speech on that basis.
It's a totally arbitrary connection as well. It's like, and how are they going to define this hate speech? So apparently me going to Parliament, because they said that I'm being investigated for racial vilification, whatever the hell that means, for giving a speech about Jewish power and influence. So if talking about Jewish power and influence in our society candidly and openly and criticizing it is racial vilification, what they're basically saying is we need to ban all critical discussion of not just the Jewish community, that's part of it, but every non-white community in Australia, because they're not just going to create anti-Semitism laws, they're going to create, you know, basically racial vilification laws that defend multicultural communities, which means everyone except whites. If you try to go and say, hey, this group is hate preaching against white Australians and I've got a problem with it, the police won't do shit. The courts won't do shit. They'll create some convoluted explanation about how they're actually an oppressed group. And so, you know, we can't find in your favor. Whites have to be criticized in order to make space for multicultural discourses or some bullshit. You know how they do it, right? So multiculturalism is code for anti-white. It's every culture except your culture, right? But anyway, Mr. Minns said he was looking to changes to the Section 93Z of the Crimes Act, which outlaws the incitement of violence on grounds of race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation, even though the New South Wales Law Reform Commission in November last year recommended no changes to the section was necessary following a nine-month review. He basically said here in this clip, I guess I can play it.
Yeah, play it. It's a very, very good video. Everyone should watch it at least once.
It's one of the reasons why we have far stricter and far tougher hate speech laws in Australia than they do in the United States. And I don't make any apologies for that. The reason we do is because we want to protect what can be a very fragile community that we've built in Australia, the multicultural community of 2025, and that's not up for debate, and it's not up for a change.
It's one of So basically, it's not up for debate. Apparently, so I thought we lived in a liberal democracy. In a liberal democracy, everything is supposed to be up for debate, isn't it? No, it's not up for debate. We're going to make it illegal for you to debate the issue of other cultures, other people groups in your country is going to be made illegal now because two of these minorities, the Muslims and the Jews, are having a dispute with each other in our country. Therefore, we have to ban any criticism of any minority group. So what this is saying is that multiculturalism is incompatible with liberal democracy. Apparently, it was not going to affect us. You know, it doesn't matter what race you are. You know, we all love freedom. We all have, you know, we can all come together as human beings. No, no, no. Your freedoms, white man, are going to get trashed. It's going to be illegal for you to defend yourself from an invasion of your country by foreign elements. Illegal for you to criticize them. We're going to put you in jail for it. And that is going to be the new paradigm. So the anti-white tyranny is now replacing liberal democracy. Very explicitly, he said it himself, free speech in the bin. It doesn't matter that the majority of Australians support free speech. He doesn't give a fuck. He's arbitrarily decided your free speech rights shouldn't exist, and so he's going to attack them. Now, we're going to fight this in the courts. We're going to battle this activistically. We're going to battle this politically in every respect. We're going to try and build a coalition against this. We're going to do everything that we can to fight this. And I think we can ultimately win. And I think the people are on our side. And, but it's, I mean, how fucked up is that?
I thought diversity was our strength.
Well, apparently it's really
fragile. It's fragile. Yeah. It's fragile, and it needs a lot of government oversight and speech laws to sustain. It's like the face of this regime or this agenda is showing itself now, isn't it? It's about this multiculturalism was all about creating bigger government, more laws, more control. Fragility.
Yeah, they're admitting that they've created fragility. They've created it on purpose. It's not up for debate, and we need stronger laws. The government needs more power to maintain the fragile state that we've made for you. That's how great it is. That's why it's our strength. So when they say our strength, they're really saying their strength, because it's certainly not us. We're subject. We're subject to it. We didn't vote for it. We didn't ask for it. Like in 1991, when Australia was 98% white or 92% white, whatever it was, they weren't like, you know what? We should bring in more Africans. There wasn't like a big public movement of like, you know, we need more, you know, Rakshans or whatever the hell that guy is. You know, let's just bring in all these darkies into the country. That's just going to be brilliant. And the crazy thing about what you said before, Joel, about they're putting these laws in place because of this fighting between the Jews and the Muslims here in Australia, it's like even better or even worse, it's because they're fighting overseas. So we've got to put laws in place in Australia because two groups are fighting overseas that have nothing to do with us, but their fifth columns exist within our society. So we need anti-hate speech laws. So what happens if China goes to war with India? How fucking fragile is Australia going to be then? And who's going to be punished? Is it going to be the Chinese mass deported under liberal democracy? Is it going to be the Indians mass deported? No, it's going to be the white people. They're going to be subject to anti-hate speech laws because anyone with common sense will be saying, why the fuck do we have 2 million Chinese in the country? No one thought this through.
Mm.
But anyway, prevention is always better than the cure. And we are the prevention because I'm telling you, the cure is mass violence. Prevention is deportations. And we're trying to be the prevention. We're trying to say, hey, look, put your support in us. You know, we're the kind of people that should be running this country. We're not ready to run it tomorrow. It's a huge infrastructure. We need a lot of support. We need a huge coalition of people working together under a singular goal. We're working towards it. It's not going to be this election cycle. It might not even be next one, although you might see us next one. And, you know, we're going to turn this country around. We have the ability to do it, and we've got the moral and physical strength to actually swing the axe on the important issues, so to speak.
It's also important to say that the Jews are obviously just using this, obviously, to attack people like us, to prevent white people from criticizing them. That's what they're really afraid of. They're not actually afraid of Muslims doing pro-Palestine rallies because they know that Australians don't give a fuck about Muslims and their issues and that it doesn't actually threaten them in a very serious way. Yeah, lefties do support Palestine, but the Muslims going out and doing pro-Palestine rallies actually makes whites like Palestine less, not more, or going and graffitiing on synagogues and so on. It doesn't improve the optics of Palestine. It doesn't, like, Palestine is better off being handled by white leftists. As soon as the Muslims get involved, they make it worse. They don't know how to sell it to white people. So the Jews aren't actually afraid of these people. The Jews are afraid of us. They're afraid of the white man criticizing them, the white man turning on them. And that's what this is all about. And they're trying to, and this is what they have always done, use multiculturalism as a weapon against white Australia. And that's how it always was from the very beginning, back in the 1960s, when this idea was birthed by the organized Jewish community. Going back to the likes of Walter Lippmann, who was installed in the Whitlam government back in the early 1970s, a leader in the organized Jewish community, who literally wrote articles talking about how Jews need to adopt a position of support for multiculturalism because they live in an Anglo-dominated society, a society that is not doesn't acquiesce enough to Jewish interests, isn't accommodating enough to Jews. And the way in which they're going to make our society more accommodating to Jews is by attacking the idea that we, the actual Australian people, should have our own country and that our culture is the culture of this country. And so they created the doctrine of multiculturalism and pushed it and created this multicultural, multi-ethnic alliance against the white man, attacked the white Australia policy, supported mass immigration, attacked all of our cultural institutions, started supporting, you know, there's been no greater friend to the so-called Aboriginal liberation or sovereignty movement than the Jews. It was Jewish lawyers who were on the side of Eddie Mabo to get the Mabo decision and the native title and all of that back in the 80s and the 90s. That was a Jewish push. It was Jews that were pushing for the Voice to Parliament referendum. It's always Jews that are pushing these agendas against us because they want to steal our fucking country from us. That's what it fucking comes down to. And they use all of this shit as a weapon against us. So it's important that people see the truth here of what's fucking going on and why, you know, when we talk about Jews, we're not just spurging out like obsessed freaks or getting too fixated upon events in other countries. This is a concrete Australian problem. The Jewish problem is an Australian problem. They have destroyed white Australia. They've been the principal antagonist. And then they go onto Sky News and try to pretend like they're your friend and they want to work with us to get the Muslims out and all of this bullshit. It's all a fucking lie. It's all a farce. It's a visage. It's not real. And they're intelligent to do that because it works, because they can use, you know, the legitimate anti-Muslim sentiment of white Australians against us to get us to support them. But we need to wake the white Australians up to, you know, the Jewish hand behind the curtain and the, you know, the game that is being played on us with this shit. So I think people are starting to come around on the Jewish issue a lot more openness to it. But we need to push. And I think that polarity that we have been creating between Jews and freedom, I mean, they're playing right into our trap. If the Jews were smart, they wouldn't double down on this right now. I really do believe that. I know some people think differently, but I think if they were smart, they would try and be like, oh, yes, our Judeo-Christian values of free speech. They do what they're doing in America right now and try and act like they're on side with the white man. But doing this, you know, it's only going to make white Australians resent them. It's only going to make white Australians realize that they are the enemies of freedom in this country and that they're attacking us. They're openly attacking us and using and basically, like, you know, disingenuously using these issues to destroy our country. And another thing that I'll say is that I do not give a fuck about getting charged with any of these bullshit laws. They can charge me, and a lot of my friends don't give a fuck either. We will fucking fight them in court, and we will fucking win. Like, I don't recognize the legitimacy of any of this shit. It's unconstitutional. It's bullshit. So they can create all these bullshit laws. They don't fucking scare me. And we're going to fucking win. This is all a fucking farce. The only way that this house of cards can be held up is if everyone accepts the delusion that any of this is legitimate. It's not. No one supports it. It's unconstitutional. and we can fucking beat this if we come together on the Australian right or patriotic Australians, and we fight this as a group, we can easily win on this issue.
Yeah, well said. Some good clips in there, I think. So get clipping, lads. Are we going to move on to Super Chats and wrap the show up? Because I've got to go soon. Yeah.
Yeah, sure, sure.
I actually might let you guys do the Super Chats and shuffle off. I've got to go see to something. But it's been a good show. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Love you all. I'll leave it to you guys, yeah?
With strength. Yeah, well, there isn't much anyway.
Yeah, that's funny. Modern World Reject said, when's Joel writing a book? Also, what's your ideal economic system, Sewell and Joel? When am I writing a book? Well, I mean, I've got a lot of writings, like notes that I've collated, but I think I might write essays before I write a book. But, you know, in time, it's when I'm an old man, I'm going to have a lot more book writing coming out probably. As a younger man, I'm more active in the world. But as for ideal economic system, I mean, we're both national socialists, but, you know, we made that pretty clear. Do you want to tackle that question, Tom, or? You don't have to.
Yeah, not really. I think when people ask questions like that, they're usually just, they're too lost in the sauce. And it, like to ask us personally, they should just develop their own understanding. You know, if they're a young guy, then they should start reading. If they're an old guy, they should start reading. If you're interested in economics, you should start with, you can look into National Socialist Economic Theory. You can even look at the foundational sort of economic theory for America. What is it, Payne? I'm not going to get into it. It's boring. Economics is boring. Donald Trump, white power. We got Musk saluting. You're asking me about economics. Next question.
Yeah, I mean,
fair day's work. A fair day's work for fair day's pay. Like, yeah. No usury, just simple stuff. Like, the whole economy should be run differently because it shouldn't be built off debt. Debt is a Jewish psyop. It shouldn't be built off debt. That's not how value creation should be. The whole thing is backwards, but I don't want to get into it. Not tonight.
Yeah, there's some authors on economic theory, Werner Sombart, Gottfried Feder, Friedrich List, Joseph Schumpeter. These are the kinds of economic theorists that I appreciate. Kalmia said, Auspil promoting Sunday Australia Day event, our guy? Well, sure seems like our guy to me. Crazy Recluse said, what do you guys think of this theory? Elon Sieg Heils to pander to far-right energy and also to energize a demoralized left against implementation of any pro-white policies for his Jewish masters. I don't really think it's energizing a demoralized left. I think it's actually only demoralizing them further because they just, the left constantly are like, the Republican Party are Nazis and, you know, but I think deep down they know that they're not. But then when Elon Musk goes to Trump's inauguration and throws a Roman, like, you know, I'm sure like the soy jack is.
Yeah. It's almost a humiliating ritual on them, not on us. Like I saw some people in our scene saying that, oh, Musk doing that is a humiliation ritual. I don't think so. If it's organized, then it's for pandering. So how is that humiliating us by him pandering? If anything, is humiliating the left. Like, you cried wolf too many times. I can throw a Roman and get away with it. He's dabbing on them. He's not dabbing on us. That doesn't make him our guy, but he's dabbing on them, not on us.
It's a humiliation for the Jews. Like, they have to sit there and watch their guy do it, and they have to, like, eat shit, basically, because obviously that's going to offend them. That's
absolutely.
That's the symbol of their enemy, you know, and they just have to eat shit. And the ADL has to be like, well, you know, he didn't actually mean it in a Nazi way. Like, suck shit to the ADL. That was very satisfying to read.
Yeah,
because it does show also that Musk is clicked up with Jews because they wouldn't fall over themselves to justify that if he wasn't. But
yes,
you know, it is what it is. Dr. Weeb said, I occasionally see rhetoric from randos trying to divide us by state affiliation. As an ethnically British, German, American, I have nothing but solidarity for my European brothers across the world, especially in other Anglosphere countries. I think it's important to remember this. Well, you're not getting any disagreement from us. And I think you can see, like, I put a lot of time and energy into supporting the pro-white position in America. It's actually the most important country politically in the world. So, you know, particularly for the white race. So that's why. But also, I genuinely love Americans. Like, I got a lot of American friends. I got some American more than friends. I love white Americans. I think it's, I think they're great people, and our destinies are tied together, but also obviously Europeans as well. Like, we care a lot about British politics because that's our ancestral homeland. Those are our people. We care a lot about Canadian politics because they're the same people. We care about German politics. We care about all of it. And we feel the love from everyone else internationally as well. So I don't know who's really undermining that position. If anyone does, yeah, though, like, fuck them.
It's Con Inc. Like, I don't see anyone outside of the establishment doing that.
I've seen Groypers say shit like, oh, we're Americans trying to, like, big dog. We don't give a fuck about Australia. And it's like...
Ah, okay. I don't really pay that, attention to it, but yeah.
That's kind of pathetic. It's like... You're kind of showing that you're kind of appealing to, like, a civic nationalism rather than, like, a racial consciousness when you do that. Like, so what? Like, oh yeah, we're all Americans, like, with our, like, Latino and, like, Negro, like, American bros, but, like, fuck you, white Australians, fuck you, Germans. It's like, okay, you're a cuck, you're a race cuck. Like, that's just fucking gay. And, like, also you're trying to, like, big dog us. When
we've all got problems,
we're all getting fucked. Like, you're not winning. Like, America's not winning. Like, the American people are occupied and are getting fucked over by this as well. So, like, it's kind of weird. Why are you identifying with, like, a Jewish empire? Like, it's just weird. But yeah, it's, like, funny. They also say they'll try and tell you about the politics of your country and at the same time tell you they don't give a fuck. It's like, well, we can't have it both ways. But I don't really get that kind of experience from Europeans, quite the opposite. I feel like Europeans are very supportive, and Americans are very supportive in general as well. Like, I think we get more support from Americans than, like, any other country by far. Like, we get more support from Americans than almost we do from Australians. So,
yeah. Well, that's historically always been the case in my experience being involved with nationalism. I remember looking at the demographics that we had on Facebook when we had 120, 130,000 followers on Facebook back in 2015. And it was majority Australian. That was the biggest demographic, but the second biggest was American, and it was huge. I think it was like 30% American. That's a huge demographic. For an Australian political movement, 30% of the followers were Americans, just, like, checking in on what's going on in Australia. And I thought that was cool. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've always felt the love from Americans in every possible way. And when I visited, I love the American people. And sometimes we'll banter the Americans, or they'll banter us. But that's, like, that's just standard, like, Anglo culture. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But yeah, like, if America has a civil war, like, we're fucking coming to help. Like, whatever the pro white team is, we're jumping in. Neo Confederates, whatever. We're helping, like, you know, we're in this together.
Yeah. Well, I like the way you said it. Our destinies are tied. And that's the shortest, best, sweetest answer. It's anyone that thinks anything different is an idiot. Our destinies are tied. There's no way that we're getting out of this as, like, microcosms. You know, we're getting out of this mess together. It's full white unity across Europe, North America, Australia, South Africa, even parts of South America. Our destinies are tied.
Yeah, absolutely. I also would say as well to people that are foreigners, like, who are whites in other continents, we have a whole fucking continent here. So we don't really want to be giving this up. Like, this is a third continent for the white race. Like, yeah, okay, there is only 20 million whites, give or take, here. But we've got a whole fucking continent. And if we can hold this continent, we can get back in control of it. We can turn it into, like, a superpower. Because we could terraform the outback, we could build cities. It's got incredible amounts of natural resources. Like, only, like, Russia and the United States have more natural resources than Australia. Like, we've got shitloads of natural resources. It's an island continent. It's, like, really defensible position. Our race should have at least three continents. I mean, we should aspire for more than three. But Europe's nowhere near enough space. North America's fantastic prime real estate, and we want to hold on to that. Obviously, that's vital. But this is great real estate too. We don't want to be giving this up. Like, our whole posture as a race is radically weakened if you lose Australia. Like, so it's more important than the, it's 20 million, but it's potentially 200 million Aryans down here if we, you know, if we can get back in control and have a century under our control, taking this place to its full potential. And then this world is ours. Like, if we can get North America back and Australia back and take both those two continents to their full potential, the white race controls this planet forever. End of story. It's over. Like, there's just simply like no coming back from that for any of our rivals. So you got to think about it like that as well. Rights for White saying, thank you guys so much for everything you do. I appreciate that. Jimmy Wright says, Maroubra Childcare Center burns down right next to a synagogue. Obvious inside job to help push anti-vilification laws through. Or a Maroubra Muzi is angry about Gaza. Rabbis have been caught spraying swastikas on their synagogues, et cetera, countless times. Yeah, we covered that on the show. Yeah, like it could be an inside job. It could be Muslims. That childcare center getting burnt down, I haven't looked into the details. So, you know, if anyone has any interesting details, like if you've got a conspiracy theory about any of this stuff, send it over to me. I'm interested to read your theories, see your evidence, because it's important. Like, if like I called out the Ripponly, you know, arson. They called it a firebombing, but it was really more of an arson. I called that out as looking sus as fuck for various reasons. And they've completely shut up about that now. You don't hear anything about that, which is what I predicted. No arrests made, no nothing. So, you know, I'm open-minded to calling these things out, but I'm not going to like jump on it and just say without looking into it, oh, it was a Jewish false flag attack. And then they arrest some Muslim who actually did it or whatever. And then I look like an asshole retard, right? So, you know, I'm going to look into it first before I put an opinion out there. Have you looked into it, Tom? I don't know.
The childcare center. No, I haven't even heard of that one. I did know. I did read that there was a, and saw the footage of like the Muslim or Muslim looking guy spray painting the temple with his the synagogue with his missus. That was like bring Habibi to the to the. That was funny. Yeah.
You know,
I think
funny.
I think a lot of these things are false flags, but some of them would be legitimate. But again, like.
Either way, it doesn't really matter. Like the political equation remains the same. Even if Muslims are, you know, burning synagogues. Number one, I don't give a fuck. And number two, what has it got to do with my free speech rights? Nothing. Like, no, it's not reasonable to associate the two things together. And even if it was reasonable, that's the fucking price of freedom, bitch. If you don't like it, get out of Australia. This is supposed to be a free country. This is an Anglo-Saxon country. We love freedom. Reardon 360 said, from America, don't believe any of the haters. We're all together in this. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, as I just said, I love Americans, and I get a million times more positive comments than negative comments. So I got no issue on that front. The Gump said, thank you for all the book tips. These kinds of recommendations are needed in order to educate ourselves with the best material possible. Yeah, I mean, I know not many people will actually read my recommendations, but a few do, and many people have got back to me over the years saying, I read this, that was fantastic, you got me to read that. So I do appreciate that. And yeah, this year, you know, we're going to cook up some theory selling podcast content and other kinds of content for those amongst you who, you know, have an intellectual ambition, who like reading, which I know is not all of you. It doesn't have to be everyone's game, but it's important if you're an intelligent man to develop your mind, your ideological understanding, your philosophical understanding, because that is the foundation, the anchor that keeps the movement oriented to the right direction, rather than just being like pulled about by like trends and hot takes without much depth. I know Tom is a man who likes to read. Jacob is a man who likes to read. Obviously, I'm a man who likes to read. You know, being a man who actually accomplishes a significant amount of reading and has a developed perspective is basically a prerequisite for being a political leader, in my opinion. Like, you can be a political soldier without being necessarily a big reader, but to be a leader, you're going to have to hit the books. don't know if you want to weigh in on that.
The only thing I'll say is it creates depth and detail to your worldview. It shouldn't change your worldview too much, but what it will do is create a lot of depth and detail. And there are millions of lessons out there to learn that you're not going to necessarily cross paths with 99% of them in order to learn them, that you can obtain from somebody else's wisdom, from somebody else's lived experience. There are people that have written books at the end of their lives, and although it might take you 24 or 48 hours, not straight, but you know what I mean, over a period of weeks or a week to read, you can absorb all the important life lessons of some of the greatest people that served our race. Like a book that was obviously life-changing for me was Mein Kampf, but another book that was very life-changing was Rockwell. In terms of just political activism, I read two of Rockwell's books in 2018, and it completely set me on a different course. It didn't change my belief system, but he articulated all these experiences that he had, especially in dealing with conservatives. Although Hitler describes that as well, and he expresses his frustrations with conservatives and LARPers and social democrats and Jews and all these people he dealt with in the political process that I'm sure we all experience dealing with Twitter, you know, which is kind of like a mini version of that. But yeah, Rockwell's experience actually creating conservative groups and actually trying to mobilize conservatives to try and save the race, and then just all the brick walls he ran into with trying to do that, and then ultimately going down the path he did, and unfortunately being assassinated. But just so many lessons to learn just about the dynamic, about the social contract that we have and the kind of people that you're going to encounter in this political struggle. And when you learn his mistakes or Pierce's mistakes, yeah, it's definitely helped me a lot. And that's just, that's not even like theory cell stuff. So theory cell stuff can go even deeper. In my opinion, the best part about reading the greats and what Joel might call the theory cell is, for me, I get an experience where I feel like new neural pathways are opening that were dormant or didn't exist, or the connection between two existing pathways weren't there. And then life is now shaped in a new form. You can see something you've already seen before, but you can see it from a different perspective now. And that allows you to actually unlock like a stronger, more governing and almost more colorful and vibrant worldview. And I don't mean that in like a kind of queer way. I mean, colorful, like there's depth, like there's layers now to it. And so when you're exposed to something simple in life or complicated in life, you actually already can see the layers of what you're dealing with. You can deal with like trends. If there's a trend that's happening, you have this clarity. And I've always noticed that with people that are well-read. In the political scene, you can tell the people that are well read often by how little they jump onto trends. They when something is happening, they can be a voice of reason and clarity because they can actually see things, the layers and the depth of what something is. So, and I can't give you concrete examples of that. You just have to read the greats. You just have to read the classics and see the neural pathways form yourself. And the brain is like a muscle. If you're not doing all these different types of exercises, you know, you're going to one day encounter a physical thing and you're not going to be able to do it. And the guy next to you is going to be able to do it. And he's never done it before either. You've both neither done the physical activity, but he can do it better than you. And he can do it better than you because he's done all these things that are similar to it, or, you know, there's a carryover mentally and physically with things. So that's all I'll add.
Yeah, I just also say that like it's necessary that we keep studying the great thinkers of the past, because so many things have already been thought through and so many ideas have been developed in this like great conversation through history. And you need to be initiated into that conversation because there's way too much thinking than you can do yourself. Like even if you're the smartest man in the world, you don't have enough brain power to do a small percentage of the total thinking that our race, our people have done over thousands of years. All the great thinkers arguing with each other, building on each other's ideas, developing ideas and so on. And so you need to become initiated into that great conversation, stand on the shoulders of giants, It's just not possible to be an accomplished and sophisticated thinker reaching your full potential otherwise. But yeah, what else have we got here? Ebenezer said, you said before that war with China would wake up racial consciousness, but you also said recently on a Twitter space or X space that younger generations are getting a terrible deal and that whites should become like barbarians who feel no attachment to the system. A war with China is also a much bigger risk for Australia than for America. I feel like your attitude on that Twitter space was right. And due to the manufacturing discrepancy, I take for granted that Zog has no chance in the war. It will be a major hit to the regime's credibility. Consequently, I see it as a great opportunity for the racist right to oppose the regime. What is your analysis? Well, that's an interesting question. I don't necessarily agree. As I said earlier, I think if the war was to break out now, I'd actually anticipate that the American alliance, I think, would win ultimately. Like, both sides would take a lot of damage, a lot of damage. But I think ultimately the Americans would take less damage and America's allies would take less damage than the Chinese would and would ultimately have a strategic victory. But
and it would lead to such drastic political changes like this. Mm. I had this argument with people on Twitter yesterday as well, because there was little sound bites from streams that went up and then people were arguing with me in the comment section saying we don't want war with China. It's like, well, yeah, of course we don't want war with China. But this idea that we can't have war with China is retarded. War with China is an inevitable. We can only delay it, and we should only delay it to our advantage. But if it was thrusted upon us, it's not a negative in the sense that, oh, but, you know, there's so many of them here already, we would lose overnight. It's like, this is this loser mentality, like we can't win. We can't win no matter what. And it's like, what would happen is we would have to make, in order to win, we would have to make changes to the structure of society in order to win. And those changes are the changes we want to make to prevent war with China, or to delay war with China, or to strengthen our position in the event of war with China. We would just have to do that radically quickly. So, for example, mass deportations. Like, all it would take is 3 or 4 or 10 or 12, however many you want, of these Chinamen to subvert the Defense Force from within. They're infested in the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force, for example, absolutely infested. And very quickly, you would start to see mass deportations. You would very start to see quarantine camps of Chinese citizens in the United States.
Concentration camps, for sure.
Yeah, just mm-hmm. As soon as the war breaks out, there will be a general that's not a complete traitor in the United States and in Australia that will be saying, okay, we're going to have to organize camps. And people are like, whoa, that's a bit intense. And then it's like, well, if we want to win, that's what we have to do. We're going to have to quarantine a whole bunch of these foreign nationals that are sleeper cells in our country. And we don't know which ones are and which ones aren't. We need to quarantine the situation and put multiculturalism just on pause, so that we can win the war. So I fucking hate the black pillars, and I hate the people that suck Chinese dick, that think that they're like the greatest thing in the world because they've got fucking 1.4 billion fucking bugs. It's like, they don't have the force projection. Yeah, they can bomb us, but they don't have the force projection. They haven't even taken Taiwan back yet. Let's not give them too much credit.
The last time they went to war with anyone was in the 80s against Vietnam, and they lost. So, I mean, they don't really have like a track record of like great military victories or anything. Now, they've got a lot of like good tech. They've got some great anti-access area denial missile systems, and they've got like hypersonic missiles and shit. And they've got some very like good missiles, and they do have a lot of raw mass. And they are building up a serious navy. So they are like, they're getting serious. Like, they're a serious threat. But the reason why China hasn't invaded Taiwan yet is because they know that the things that I'm saying about America's various advantages are real. Because if they weren't real, they wouldn't be deterred. They would have already taken Taiwan by now. Because exactly. It is a national embarrassment that they haven't. Because according to Chinese state policy, and even according to American state policy, Taiwan is part of China. Like, it's legally part of China, according to basically every country in the world. So the fact that it's not politically part of China, and that the Americans are filling it full of weapons and militarily guaranteeing it, is actually a massive fuck you to China. And they're just kind of still, you know, they're still wearing that. So yeah, it's obviously a very complex situation and it's very hard to predict. Like World War III is the most complicated event ever in like human history, in all recorded history. So for me to sit here or you to sit there and say, this is exactly how it's going to happen, would be ridiculous. We don't actually know exactly how it's going to happen. There's way too many moving parts, right? But the idea that China would definitely win, I think there's a lot of reasons to think that America has advantages. Now, it could go either way. I'm not a war hawk that's like, yes, let's fucking go to war with China, all exactly. Fucking themes ahead. I'm not a war hawk. But at the same time, I'm a realist. I recognize that this is the legacy superpower and an emerging superpower. There's something called Thucydides' trap, right? You know, where this is a trope that has played out many times in history. You have a legacy superpower, a rising superpower, or a legacy power and a rising power. Britain, Germany in Europe, or go back, you know, Athens, Sparta. You know, these things have happened many, many times throughout history. And eventually there's usually a clash, right? And the thing is, from like, if you look at the world structurally, America's national defense is built around the premise, like their national security policy is built around the premise of preventing another superpower existing on the earth, because they're a superpower. So they're like, if we allow another superpower to come into existence, they could fuck with us. But right now, we're the big dog. We're the big dick. We can like no one in the American continent can fuck with us. Mexico can't fuck with us. Brazil can't fuck with us. None of these cunts have a chance. The only people that have a chance at messing with us, if something happens with the Europeans, maybe a European alliance around Germany or something like that, the Russians and China or Japan, these are the potential big dogs. So if someone can rise and dominate Europe, whether it be the Russians, whether it be the Germans or some alliance, or someone can dominate East Asia, whether it be the Chinese or the Japanese or whatever, if they dominate their region, now they can start projecting force outside of their region. They can start projecting force into South America. They can start allying with partners in Europe and contest us for control in Europe or vice versa. Like, and now all of a sudden, America's on the back foot. We're right now they're in the most dominant possible position where the two main zones where superpowers could rise, East Asia and Europe, are divided. They're divided between an American enemy and a series of American ally client states. So the status quo is very good for America. They're kind of holding China and Russia back. And, you know, China and Russia try to make alliances with South American countries and stuff like that, but it's nothing serious. But imagine if China was able to take East Asia and they were able to dominate East Asia, and then they could start building alliances and start pushing through Eurasia, start trying to take over Europe, start pushing into South America. All of a sudden, America is now in China's world rather than China being in America's world. And they don't want to be in China's world. They want to be in America's world. And China wants to be in China's world rather than in America's world and so on. So there's just like a natural, that's like a natural rivalry. It's not just like when they rounded us up to go and fight in Iraq because it would be good for Israel, there's no natural reason why it would make sense for us to invade Iraq. We had nothing to gain there, no benefit there. No, there was no threat to our national security from Iraq. That whole thing was a lie. So we opposed that war, right? Because it's like, this is not benefiting us. Why are we spending trillions and having all these, you know, young white soldiers go and die for fucking Israel? This is retarded. So we opposed that war. But a war against China, it's like, okay, I can kind of understand the system going to war against China. I can kind of understand that this is about like imperial competition, clash of civilizations, and China are not our friends. Now, yeah, America's run by Jews, run by a regime that isn't our friends either, but China, the fucking Chinese, right? They are a completely different race. They are not our friends. If Australia tried to make an alliance with China, what that would translate to is our country getting filled up with Chinese immigrants, all of our economy being integrated into the Chinese economy, taking over all of our media, taking over all of our companies, assets, everything, and Australia turning into becoming China-fied. That's destroying Australia forever. It's no longer white Australia's done, toast, it's finished. Like, you know, so that's not a deal that's on the table. That makes any sense. Now we're allied with America. And that also kind of sucks, obviously, or more than kind of sucks. It really sucks because America has been run by an anti-white Jewish regime that's been promoting multiculturalism and diversity and all this shit. And all these Jewish bankers in Wall Street own all our big companies and are like, you know, basically forced us to enter into all these international agreements that shipped all our manufacturing offshore and fucked us over and destroyed our national sovereignty. And so that also sucks. But at the very least, America's got 200 million white people in it. At the very least, there's a chance that if white Americans can reassert themselves, we can reassert ourselves. So America's victory is better than China's victory. You know, in the grand scheme of things, there's at least a chance of white power. There's at least the semblance of being part of Western civilization. And there's still a bunch of white dudes in charge of the empire and these systems under the status quo. So that doesn't mean that I massively support America or that we shouldn't criticize America or any of this kind of stuff in its current formulation. But, you know, we're between a rock and a hard place here. You know, we don't have, there's no like, if we can't just go like, oh, we're staying out of it, we have no business with either side. Like, that's not how politics works. That's not how international politics works. We're forced to pick a side. And we've picked a side. We can't come along and go, we in the National Socialist Network advocate for leaving the American alliance. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, everyone, we all, like, that's just not a realistic political position. So you just, at a certain point, you have to have realism and say, okay, we've picked a side. We're getting the nuclear subs from America. We've got all these defense agreements. America has nuclear, like fucking, military bases in our country. We're part of the American empire, for better or worse. So if we're going to go to war, let's look at the practicalities. If we're going to go to war, like what Tom was saying, we're going to have to deport chinks. We're going to have to bring patriotism back. We're going to have to get rid. There's got a whole, like basically a whole bunch of our critiques of society have to be listened to if we're going to do this World War III thing seriously. So why wouldn't we lean into that rather than being like, we oppose the regime, get thrown in a concentration camp with all the chinks and everyone call, you know, they call us like traitors to the country or something. And then we become an irrelevant, like jailed political movement. It's not like in World War II, where we were fighting the Germans or something, and there was a principled stance where,
yeah, exactly,
we were fighting a side that represented our race that actually would have defended the British Empire.
That was a brothers' war. Could you imagine if there was like Australian nationalists back in 1941 that were like, "No, we shouldn't go to war with Japan. Let's let them have Singapore." Like these fucking critics, I can't even go into any more detail because it just makes me angry how stupid they are. I just don't want to have the conversation with them. They're just not thinking straight. And that's what I said to all of them that were commenting on my posts, saying like, what, you would die for Zog? And it's just like, you're not thinking straight. If we go to war with China, we're at war with China. You're not dying for Zog. Like, fuck. Like, yes, Zog is involved, but like these people are so delusional that like ideally we don't die for Zog and ideally we don't die in a war against China. We live in a happy, healthy, white Australia. That's the ideal situation. But this idea that some of, and the reason why they ask the question and why they're so catty about the question is because they actually are so delusional. They believe that we would be better off under Chinese rule than Zog rule. They're that delusional. And it's like, no, that's not the case. Yes, the Jews are a bigger threat than the Chinese, but the Jews have to play a game with us and we can defeat the Jew with Aryan magic. It's quite, what we're doing is working. We just need to keep going. We can defeat the Jew. We can root the Jew out of our society and they're going to have to go play their Jewish trick somewhere else. We are going to be able to beat them, not at their game, but at our game. Whereas China, there is no game. It's just war. There is no game. There's no like once you've got the Chinese overlords here in Australia, it's you work in bauxite mine. You in bauxite mine. And if you say no, they shoot you. Like there's no game to play with them. There's no way to outmaneuver them or out. You have to beat them in war or you're done. You're basically genocided. So with the Jews, we have a different conflict with them. We're fighting their subversion. Whereas the Chinese, they're only subverting us because we're letting them and because we're fighting the Jews. So yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Exactly.
It is getting late. There's a couple more questions, but I'm gonna head off. It is. It's been three. Yeah. Hours.
That kind of set us off. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, also,
just the audience. I think most of the audience understands this, but don't. If you're in the audience and you know maybe you've taken too much of the Dugan pill or something, whatever your problem is, don't ever think that it's like just the Jews. I think that's the chronic issue with this caliber of criticism of our critique of, you know, geopolitics. They've got this singular mind that it's just the Jews. They're not looking at the multifacetedness of the problem.
Yeah, that's true on so many of these issues. It's like, yes, we oppose the Jews. But if you boil everything down just to that, you start saying, let's not talk about Paki rape gangs because the Jews want us to.
Yeah, well, I had a guy comment on the video of us doing the protest outside the Chinese embassy, and the guy commented something like, oh, why don't you ever point out what the Jews are doing?
Yeah, so I was like, going after he's out rally against the Jews, bro. Yeah,
the comment was, why are you going after the Chinese? Why aren't you going after the Jews? It's like, can't we're going after all of them. We've criticized and attacked and protested all of them. Like anyway, crazy. I shouldn't get worked up. It's obviously bait.
Yeah, but it's important. This is important stuff.
Yeah, it is. All right. I mean,
we're done anyway. There's just a comment from this last guy. He said, I want the average white person, especially the average Anglo, to have the same feelings about the rape of British children as the Jews have towards their Holocaust story. The worst and most unforgivable depravities have been perpetrated against us, and people don't have near enough anger over it. And that's very true, and that's a good sentiment, I think, to end the show. And we'll see you all next time. I'll let you know when we're streaming again. I don't know if we're going to do a stream Thursday this week, but I'll let you know. We'll do a stream again soon. But until then, white fucking power.
Hail.